Thumbs up. Okay. Good morning. Thank you all for attending today. And this meeting is being webcasted and recorded, so all participants, please speak clearly. Members of the public who wish to observe or to address the board may join the meeting at the noticed physical location or may use the Zoom application to address the board from a remote location. For people who want to listen or watch the meeting, the board's customary webcast is available at www.cal-span.org. In addition, we're receiving presentations and public comment through a Zoom meeting platform. If you intend to present or comment or think you might be interested in commenting, you should already be in the meeting, in the Zoom meeting room, using the meeting ID and the password you received from the clerk. If you've not already received the meeting ID and the password, you can go to our website at www.waterboards.ca.gov/northcoast. Click on the August 14th to 15th, 2025 board meeting button and follow the instructions to complete a virtual speaker card. You will then receive an email from the clerk with the Zoom login information. For anyone here in the meeting room that wishes to address the board, please complete a speaker card available on the table outside the boardroom and give it to the clerk. For those in the meeting room, your camera will be turned off and you will be on mute until it is your turn to speak. The clerk will unmute you when it is your turn to address the board. We will call each commenter by name and then unmute each commenter. I would like to ask those who have provided a contact name to please state your name for the record before you speak. There's a normal 5-minute time limit for each commenter. During public testimony, you will see a timer on the screen. For those calling in by phone, we will run the timer and let you know when you have 30 seconds left or when your time is up. Please participate from a quiet environment so that the board can hear you when you are called upon during public comment. When you are done speaking and the board members have completed asking questions, you will be placed on mute. You can remain in the Zoom meeting until the completion of your item, and then you may choose to exit the meeting or continue. And we're going to move on to the agenda, and we'll please stand for the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. And pause a minute and think about that. Liberty and justice for all. Let's hope that happens. Okay, roll call from my right.
Jake McKenzie, the illustrious board member, as I'm called, and this morning I was called a saint by Senator McGuire at Starbucks, so I'm from Rohnert Park. I'm now a saint, officially. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Alex, if you would, please.
Alex Hart from Siskiyou County. I apologize I can't be with you all, but there was kind of a emergency situation and I needed to be up north. So good to see everybody.
Thank you. Hector Bedoya from the Healdsburg area.
I was waiting for a benediction from the saint. So, Greg Giusti, Ukiah.
Ryan Sundberg, McKinleyville, Humboldt County.
Valerie, please.
Good morning, Chair Bedoya and members of the board. I'm Valerie Quinto, Executive Officer. To my left is Nathan Jacobson, counsel to the board. To my right are Josh Curtis and Claudia Villacorta, Assistant Executive Officers. Across from me is Deidre Wilkerson, Executive Assistant. And other staff will introduce themselves as their items come up. I also just wanted to note, as I make a point to share with the board when we have new members of our office leadership team, and just wanted to note that since our last board meeting, we have hired a new unit senior of the Northern Agriculture Unit, And that is Shannon Utley, an engineering geologist who's been on our staff for over 8 years and has over 15 years in state service. So we're really excited to welcome Shannon to the leadership team. That's it. Thanks.
Thank you.
Is Shannon in the room?
She is not. Shannon works primarily out of our Eureka office.
Board members, do you have anything to report? Meetings, communications, correspondence? There being none, is Dee Dee available?
Good morning. Yes, I am. Good to see you, Chair and members of the board. I'll start off my report this morning with water measurement and reporting. We updated on August 5th, our board adopted revisions to the diversion measurement and reporting regulation. This regulation was originally adopted in 2016 to implement legislation SB 88 that was adopted during the historic drought 2014-15. This legislation requires reporting of surface water diversions of over 10 acre feet. And since it's been implemented for several years, staff thought that it was important and the board agreed that to have some updated regulations that will facilitate more accurate analysis of supply and demand of surface water as a result of having more frequent reporting for a certain class of diverters. Allow for additional opportunities to correct reporting errors, because we have been seeing quite a few reporting errors in what's been submitted, and then to improve communication with diverters and hopefully result in greater compliance rate. We have been disappointed in the compliance rates, and so starting to do some enforcement actions, but really wanting to focus on compliance rather than enforcement. And we think that this updated regulation will assist in that effort. In July, our Division of Water Rights released a report summarizing research completed in advance of the division's Russian River telemetry study that is being kicked off. Highlights of the report will assist in the further development of the study. And the highlights of the report include an assessment of current telemetry data formats and content in SB 88 measurement files, external perspectives on water measurement technology from a technical group, and interviews of equipment manufacturers who provide the measurement technologies to reporters. Information is available on the division's website under the Russian River Telemetry Pilot Project, and volunteer sites for the study have been selected and work is underway for station installation. So stay tuned for future updates on that. An update on Tribal Affairs Program. From July 31st to August 1st, the California Water Boards co-hosted the 2025 Tribal GIS Summit with California Tribal Geographical Information Systems. The summit goals were to advance indigenous geospatial capacity, data sovereignty, and environmental stewardship. Specific focus for this summit was on indigenous data sovereignty, environmental monitoring, climate resilience, and interagency collaboration. This is the time of year where we adopt our intended use plans for the drinking water and clean water state revolving fund programs. And so at our August 5th meeting, we did adopt the clean water state revolving fund intended use plan for the coming year. And at our upcoming board meeting next week, we'll be turning our attention to drinking water with consideration of adoption of the annual drinking water state revolving fund intended use plan. And then after that, we will be at a later board meeting updating our fiscal year 2025-26 fund expenditure plan for the Safer Drinking Water Program. And speaking of SAFER, the Safe and Affordable Funding for Equity and Resilience, On July 1st, the application period opened up for 10 seats on the advisory committee board for the 2026-2027 term. And I'm looking here for the deadline. The deadline for application is August 31st. This group is just really helpful to our board. The SAFER Advisory Group provides constructive feedback and input regarding the safe and affordable drinking water fund expenditure plan and other related topics. The group is made up of 20 appointed members that represent public water systems, technical assistance providers, local agencies, NGOs, the public, and residents that are served by community water systems in disadvantaged communities, state small water systems, and domestic wells. We like to have a good diverse group, and so cycle in and out new members periodically. So really want to encourage anyone that might be interested in applying to just Google State Water Resources Control Board, SAFER Advisory Group. Okay, and as I have been updating you in the past on our busy administrative hearing officer's calendar, on June 20th, the Administrative Hearings Office released an updated hearing notice for the Delta Conveyance Project, and the evidentiary portion of the public hearing resumed on August 12th, and will continue on throughout the month of August, September, and October via Zoom. And for those that are interested in just kind of following in the background, there's a YouTube link information in the notice. Okay, turning our attention to fees, on July 31st and August 1st, staff held the final round of stakeholder meetings to discuss the fiscal year 2025-26 fees. Staff is in the process of developing a package of proposed changes for the 2025-26 Drinking Water Environmental Lab Accreditation Program, Water Quality and Water Rights, and SGMA fee schedule changes to the board for consideration at our September 16th board meeting. And then lastly, I'll update you on the Agricultural Expert Panel. This is through our Irrigated Lands Regulatory Program with the water boards, collectively, all of us with the regional boards as well. Staff has been working with the California State University Sacramento, the contractor on this project, to convene an expert panel to provide input regarding water boards' irrigated land regulatory programs. This is the second statewide expert panel convened by our board, with the first one having been convened in 2014. As a result of the 2014 expert panel, they provided a report that our board relied on quite a bit in the adoption of our precedential irrigated lands order when we reviewed the East San Joaquin program that I know you all are using for your program. Pursuant to our 2023 irrigated lands order, where we reviewed the Central Coast's updated irrigated lands program, we felt that it was appropriate at this time to convene a second statewide expert panel to review data that has been submitted thus far in these programs, and for the board, or the expert panel, to provide recommendations to our board. The first meeting was on August 8th, and the second one is, I believe, starting at about 10 o'clock this morning. The meetings are hybrid, and the panel is taking public comments. And for those of you who are not able to follow, there's going to be recordings that you can access, and also there will be additional opportunities, but those dates have not yet been released. I expect it'll be later in this fall. That's all I have, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Dee Dee. Appreciate your comments, your updates, and wanted to ask you if it's a requirement for water companies to test for PFAS throughout the state, these forever chemicals, does the state require specific testing?
Not at this time. What we have right now is required testing for certain areas. We actually, I believe we're going to have an information item on this soon. And right now, what we have is required testing in certain areas of the state where the PFAS, these forever chemicals, are suspected to be occurring. And that is assisting our staff with regard to next steps on this. And what I'd like to do is provide you with the PowerPoint that our staff has developed on this and further information about the upcoming information item. We're starting to get some very detailed information about where, because of the testing that's occurred at landfill sites and areas where firefighting chemicals have been used, it's really providing a greater picture about the impacts throughout the state. And there's some embedded in within that, some good news as well, where it was maybe expected to be more serious of a situation than what staff has found. But this is an evolving area, and I'd like to provide you with more information on that. And in my next report, I'll make sure I include an information item on that.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair. Good morning, Dee Dee. I hope you are well. Just a question. A lot of your report today had to do with various funding and financial issues. Have you or has the State Board or Cal EPA experienced any cuts in federal funding that you were expecting, or do you see any risks of funds that were targeted for California that are at risk of being pulled at this time that could affect water and water quality in the state?
The impacts that we've seen thus far are minimal. The concern initially was that all of these programs that I was talking about here today, the Clean Water Revolving Fund and Drinking Water Revolving Fund, would be vulnerable. But at this point, the funds seem to be doing okay. And then we have the, there was some limited amount that had not yet been spent. And again, because I'm not prepared to talk about it specifically, I think what I'd like to do is provide more specifics at my on my next report. But overall, the programs are moving along quite well, and we do have opportunities for additional funding sources through Prop 4.
Yeah, I didn't mean to catch you flat-footed, but I think if given a heads up, your next your next presentation to this board, given the volatility of federal funds, I think it would be of interest to a wide audience to know how some of these decisions coming out of Washington are directly impacting, you know, your board, potentially our board, and even Cal EPA. That would be very interesting. I thank you for your time on that.
Agreed.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you for the question.
Yes, Valerie.
I also just wanted to note for board members, in addition to any info that Board Member Diadamo can provide during her next update, I also wanted to share that at our December meeting, we're planning to have the Water Board's Division of Financial Assistance give a presentation, an information item to our board, sharing information about the range of funding programs that are offered through that division. And that would include programs with federal funding, programs with Prop 4 funding. So that may not be getting at the exact same question, but that will also be an opportunity for the board and public to hear some comprehensive information about the funding resources that are currently available and that are coming up.
Thank you. Jake?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Funding is on my mind as well. Didi, I attended the Monday afternoon forum by our North Coast legislators, co-chaired by Senator Cabaldon and Assembly Member Connolly, on the subject of funding for Sonoma State University. pro tem. Senator McGuire was also on that panel, along with Assembly Member Rogers. And one of the items that came up was to establish a environmental sciences department with the intent that there would be continuing geology instruction. As many of us know, many of our geologists here on the regional board are graduates of Sonoma State University, and in the past it has been one of the educational institutions on which we and cities and counties have relied in the North Bay. I believe it was mentioned that to help to support the establishment of this environmental sciences department, that some monies would be coming from the State Water Board. And I was wondering if you could enlighten us on that, or if you could confirm that at our next meeting. I believe the sum of $2 million was mentioned, but there were no handouts, and so I apologize for not bringing this up under matters from the board, but it's extremely important, I believe, and two of our geologists testified at the hearing as to the benefits of the geology program, and it would be part of the, presumably part of this new environmental sciences department. So thanks for listening to me on that.
Well, thank you. I am not aware of it, but you've piqued my interest, so I'll follow up on it. You know, we're a fee-based organization, and so unfortunately we don't usually have extra pots of money, but you've piqued my interest on this in particular because I used to serve on the Air Resources Board, and we had a separate fund just for research. And so it was really, I think, a good opportunity for us to provide, you know, some seed funding for very worthy research projects. And so we don't, I've advocated for that since I've been at the Water Board, but with no success. So I'm curious where this $2 million might be coming from, and I'll look into it.
Keep up the good fight.
Board members, any questions for Dee Dee? Well, Dee Dee, thank you very much. It's good to see you.
Thank you.
Okay, moving on to board chair's report. Well, I'm asking you to consider supporting gleaning groups, food banks in your area, food pantries. There's an abundance of backyard fruits, summer fruit. If you have a surplus of garden vegetables, please call the gleaning groups and or take your excess to the food banks. They provide an incredible service, and with dwindling funds, it's hard, you know, and school starting. Food banks and food pantries provide a great service to the community. Okay, we will move on to approval of minutes. I'll entertain a motion.
So move, Mr. Chair.
Second.
Deidre?
Board Member McKenzie?
Aye.
Board Member Sundberg?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hart?
Aye.
Chair Bedoya?
Aye.
Board Member Giusti?
Aye.
You have a public forum.
Thank you. Oh, yes, I overlooked that. Public forum, item number six. Do we have anybody from the general public?
We do have one person on Zoom for public forum.
Oh. I apologize to that person if they're hearing. Please let them in.
Hi, Jamie. Can you state your name to make sure we can hear you? And I'm going to, if you just give me a minute, I'll pull up the timer for you.
Yes. This is Jamie Nearing.
We can hear you. Thank you.
Go ahead, Jamie.
Good morning, Chair Bedoya and members of the board. My name is Jamie Neri, and I am Policy Director and Staff Attorney for Russian Riverkeeper. Today, I want to provide a few brief comments in relation to tomorrow's Executive Officer Report and the related materials that will provide the board with an update on the status of the triennial review projects. Of particular importance to us is the narrative and stream flow water quality objective that was identified as a priority project for the 2024 to 2027 triennial review period. We see this as an important step to improving water quality within our region and ensuring that a more holistic approach is taken for management of our waters. And as reflected in the June 2025 Regional Water Board updates to the Basin Plan, climate change is here and its impacts to flows go beyond water levels themselves. This is because flow levels are strongly tied to things like temperature, pollutant concentrations, flow velocity, dissolved oxygen, and they also relate to the presence of potentially harmful algal blooms and a variety of other harms within our watershed. And it is time that these interrelationships and different connections are acknowledged and addressed. So we're really happy to see this project in the work plan with a renewed effort and interest in getting it across the finish line last year, or getting it into the work plan last year, sorry. However, we must note that we remain concerned that this project will continue to be pushed further out to some unknown time, and that we are again facing a repeat of past attempts to establish an in-stream flow water quality objective. As we understand this project, it is already more than a year behind schedule, with peer review not scheduled till 2026. And the staff report that was originally slated for January of this year now being pushed beyond that, or now being pushed beyond the peer review, which is expected next year. And there's also still, as far as we're aware, tribal consultation, state water board review, and CEQA scoping must all still occur as well. And these are all very time-intensive processes and are likely to result in further delays beyond this triennial review period. We recognize there are staffing changes, that this is a robust topic that takes time to be done correctly. And we really do appreciate that staff are doing what they can to ensure this process is moving forward with limited resources. But we are worried that without sufficient railings, this is going to continue being death by a thousand delays. More than a decade has passed since this board first identified the importance of a narrative in-stream flow objective and started setting it as a priority. Between climate change impacts and ongoing and future water supply strains in our region, it is really important that this water quality objective be adopted to help ensure the protection of our beneficial uses in the face of these and other changes. Climate change is not going to wait for us to be prepared. For these reasons, we respectfully request that the board establish a realistic timeline with set milestones for this project to ensure it gets back on track and is completed without further delay. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you for your comment.
Mr. Chair, if I could just have a comment to Jamie's. She's absolutely right. We've been talking about this for 10 years, and it's something that I have always thought was imperative even 10 years ago. And I think, as Jamie's representing the Russian River Group, given the expected changes of the Russian River flow in the coming years, don't know when, but certainly within the next 10 years, there's going to be major changes on that diversion and water going into the Russian River. I just want to support her comments that this needs to be continued to move forward in a reasonable manner. And I know Executive Officer agrees with me on that. And for all of the reasons, it's slow. But nonetheless, it still should be a priority of this board. And I just want to thank Jamie for her comments let her know that she's got a supporter of her comments. I'm sure I'm not the only one, but at least one supporter of her comments on that she shared with us. So thank you, Jamie.
Jamie, I have to agree, as a former board member of the Russian River Keeper. Hopefully this will be adopted soon. And thank you for bringing it up. Okay, moving on to item number two. Next on the agenda is item number two, public hearing on the rescission of National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System permit rescission order R1-2025-0024. Waste Discharge Requirements Order Number R1-2000-0017 for the State of California Department of Fish and Game and Pacific Corp. Iron Gate Hatchery. This was scheduled as an uncontested item when the agenda was issued. If there are no comments from the permittee, public board members, or staff, I will consider this an uncontested matter and proceed directly to a vote. Deidre, is there any commenter?
No.
Thank you. I'll now entertain a motion to adopt the rescission order number R1-2025-0024.
I so move, Mr. Chair.
Is there a second?
I second. Thank you.
Deidre?
Board Member McKenzie?
Aye.
Board Member Sundberg?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hart?
Aye.
Chair Bedoya?
Aye.
Board Member Giusti?
Aye.
Thank you. We're moving on to item number four. A hearing officer's statement for administrative civil liability hearing, administrative civil liability complaint issued to Michael Harding. This is a time and place for a public hearing to consider issuance of an order for administrative civil liability to Michael Harding for violations alleged in the administrative civil liability complaint R1-2025-0022. The complaint alleges violations related to a cannabis development site in Mendocino County. The complaint seeks penalties of $66,468.75 for violations of the Water Code Section 13267. This hearing will be conducted in accordance with the notice of public hearing and procedures document that was issued with the complaint and instructions provided today. In this matter, we have separated the functions of staff between those who are acting in a prosecutorial role and will be presenting the proposed order, complaint, and evidence for this board's consideration, and those who will advise the board and its consideration of this matter. All parties are subject to the same applicable rules and regulations, including the prohibition on ex parte communication with board members and the advisory team. The advisory team for this matter includes Board Executive Officer Valerie Quinto and counsel to the board, Nate Jacobson. The prosecution team and the other parties will introduce themselves as the hearing proceeds. This hearing will be conducted in both person and via video conference. During this hearing, the board will consider relevant evidence and testimony to decide whether to issue an order assessing the proposed liability, issue a modified order assessing a higher or lower amount, or to reject the proposed liability. The prosecution team has submitted a proposed order for the board's consideration. Mr. Harding did not submit a proposed order, argument, or evidence for the board's consideration. Generally, the order of the hearing will be as follows. 1. Opening statements. 2. Prosecution team's case presentation and direct testimony from witnesses. 3. Cross-examination of prosecution witnesses. 4. Harding case presentation and direct testimony from witnesses. 5. Cross-examination of Harding's witnesses. 6. Prosecution's rebuttal and Harding rebuttal as necessary. And 7, closing arguments.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I apologize. You may have said this earlier and I missed it, but I just, if in case there's anybody online, watching specifically for item three, the workshop on the Wallala River Sediment TMDL action plan. I just wanted to make sure that that anyone watching and waiting for that item is aware that we, because of board member schedule limitations today, we decided to move this item four hearing before the Wallala workshop, but that workshop will still take place after this item. So just wanted to make sure that folks understood what was happening with the order of the agenda.
Thank you for bringing that up. Okay, to continue on the procedure. Step eight, public comments, if any, following the conclusion of the parties' cases and any members of the public wishing to give non-evidentiary policy statements will have 5 minutes to do so. Number nine, board deliberation and consideration of order. The board may meet in closed session to deliberate on this matter. Is Mr. Harding attending the hearing? Deidre.
He's not on Zoom. I don't believe he's here in person either.
Okay. Do the parties have any questions?
None from the prosecution team.
I remind you that each witness that the parties intend to call will be required to take an oath. For those planning to give testimony, please stand up and take the following oath. Do you swear the testimony you're about to give is the truth?
I do.
Prior to testifying, please state your name, affiliation, and whether you have taken the oath. As was stated in the hearing procedure, each party will be allowed a total of 30 minutes. Neither party requested additional time. I may modify these procedures and time allocations as needed and upon request for good cause. The board members or members of the advisory team may ask questions at any time. The timer will stop for procedural discussions, questions from the board members or the advisory team, and other causes such as technical issues. The timer will show time left to each party. Any other matters from the parties or the advisory team before we begin?
No.
Okay. I would like to ask the parties now whether they would like to make an opening statement. If so, we will begin with an opening statement from the prosecution team.
Yes, I'll make an opening statement. Yes, please. Okay. Timer ready? Or, yeah. Good morning, Chair Bedoya and members of the board. I'm Kason Grady of your staff, and I've taken the oath. I am supervisor of the Agriculture and Enforcement Division and the Cannabis Program, Regional Cannabis Program Manager. I'm joined by our Assistant Executive Officer, Claudia Villacorta, as the lead prosecutor of this case. And I'm also joined to my right by Hermias Berge, our lead technical staff geologist for this case, and to my left, staff counsel Heather Jitkoff. And we're also joined by other members of the prosecution team. They'll introduce themselves. Let me see if my clicker works. Great. Okay, so during today's presentation, the prosecution team will provide an overview of this enforcement case, including the property location, the site history and background, and we'll present a chronology of the enforcement actions and compliance assistance that we've provided, and all the different communications we've had with the respondent. We'll then discuss in more detail the violations that the prosecution team is alleging and provide a brief overview of the liability factors and adjustments used to calculate the proposed liability today. So we're here today to present a case against Michael Harding for your consideration to impose a liability in the amount of $66,468.75 for failure to comply with a cleanup and abatement and investigative order issued by this board in response to unlicensed cannabis cultivation. His violations of the cleanup order include failure to submit a completion report of winterization of his property and failure to submit a cleanup restoration and monitoring plan. This action is consistent with the regional cannabis program enforcement strategy that I presented to this board last December because it implements strategy element 1C by conducting expedited enforcement of an unregulated cannabis cultivation site and by prioritizing penalty assessment for violation of a cleanup and abatement and investigative order. As Mr. Berhe will elaborate further, rather than comply with the cleanup and abatement order by submitting the report and the plan, Mr. Harding decided to sell the property in an apparent effort to avoid liability and responsibility for the cleanup. But that would be a miscalculation based on a misunderstanding of the law. Indeed, we are currently engaged with the current landowner in an effort to get the site cleaned up. But that does not relieve Mr. Harding of his liability for his non-compliance with the order, and it does not eliminate his responsibility to ensure site cleanup. Mr. Harding has failed to engage with us through this hearing process and has therefore failed to make an inability to pay argument. Mr. Berhe will demonstrate that our prosecutorial staff have fulfilled our burden of proof to demonstrate that he does indeed have the ability to pay the penalty from the proceeds from the property sale and other property assets. So to be clear, we're bringing this case to you today because Mr. Harding remains responsible for the cleanup and continues to be liable for his noncompliance. The prosecution team asserts that it is important to hold prior landowners liable so that cannabis cultivators and other dischargers understand that selling properties after receiving a cleanup and abatement order from this board does not relieve oneself of responsibility to comply, and that it is in everyone's best interest to work with staff and comply with board orders. If we were to not have brought this case to you today, or by not adopting this penalty today, it could send the message that all someone has to do to avoid responsibility and liability is to just ignore board orders and then sell their property before the board issues a penalty. This would have dire consequences on our effectiveness and our authority. So I encourage you to be bold with us today and hold Mr. Harding accountable for his noncompliance by issuing the penalty and show that compliance is not optional. Mr. Berhe, our lead technical staff geologist, will now present the evidence and rationale to support the recommendation to adopt the liability amount proposed in the complaint. That's the end of our closing statement. Thank you. Opening statement. Is there a procedural step before we have Mr. Berhe start?
Yeah, I've already sworn.
And you say your name for the record.
Dear Chair Bedoya and members of the board, I am Ermias Berhe of your staff here at the North Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board. I am a geologist and I have been working with this board for the last 6 years as an engineering geologist in the cannabis program. And I have sworn in today. I prepared the declaration submitted as PT-31, and I affirm the statements in that document are true and correct. Now, I will proceed to my presentation by showing location map of the property. The property is in northern Mendocino County, northwest of the town of Covelo, adjacent to Round Valley Reservation. The map on the left shows the property location as a red star, and the map on the right shows the property boundary with a red hashed polygon. Next. This is a closer view of the property, showing its proximity to the Eel River, which runs along the bottom, approximately within 0.2 miles. This map also shows tributaries of the Eel River draining directly from the property, as featured in purple lines here. to show the property condition and the impacts of cannabis cultivation and associated activities. Here is a slide contrasting historical imagery from pre- and post-property development for cannabis cultivation and associated activities. The pre-development image is from May of 2014. Next. And the post-development image is from August of 2017. We will use purple circles in these images to show locations of on-stream ponds. Here is the northern pond as it existed in 2014, and here are the ponds visible in 2017 following site development activities. Red squares here show graded pads and greenhouses, and these broken blue lines are watercourses located in the vicinity of the developed structures. None of these developed features, including on-stream ponds and watercourse crossings, were authorized by the North Coast Regional Water Board.
Question, if I may, going back to that slide. The new ponds, are those ponds created by diverting existing surface water?
Yes.
And do you know if the individual filed any 1600 permits with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife for those diversions?
No.
No, he didn't, or no, you're not aware?
I'm not aware, but I don't think he did when he versed originally.
You are certain that they are diversions of surface waters?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Next. To be clear, the purple circles and red squares that you see on this slide are the same as featured on the previous slide. This image from May 2025 is the most recent available image showing conditions at the site. In this image, we see the remains of the greenhouses in red squares and the ponds in purple circles, as well as access roads between them, all present after issuance of the cleanup order on October 17, 2024. Next. To serve as the background information for this complaint, I will now briefly discuss my inspection findings. I inspected the property on September 26, 2022. During my inspection, I observed unpermitted cannabis cultivation and related activities which discharged and threatened discharge to waters of the state. Conditions at the property include improperly stored or disposed trash, potting soil, generators and gasoline containers, unauthorized septic system, and unauthorized dredge and fill activities. On October 25, 2022, I transmitted an inspection report and a notice of violation documenting the conditions I observed on the property. Thanks. Here are some photos documenting conditions at the property which I took in my September 26, 2022 inspection. Starting at the top from left to right, the first four photos show potting soil and trash discharged to land, a waste pipe from a structure entering underground and within a repair and setback threatening waste discharge to groundwater and surface water, disposed cannabis plant waste, gasoline-powered pump and gasoline containers without secondary containments and cover threatening waste discharge, and the four bottom photos show controllable sediment delivery sites associated with cannabis with unauthorized dredge and fill activities. The dashed blue lines are included to indicate the approximate locations of watercourses at the inlet and outlet of the ponds, and the yellow arrows to show sediment delivery sites. As can be seen from the second photo on the bottom, the southern on-stream pond showed signs of erosion on the inside of its embankment, delivering sediment to waters of the state. And the bottom right photo show erosion and sediment delivery at the outlet of a culvert. As you can see on the timeline presented here, staff attempted to encourage compliance and gave the respondent sufficient time to hire a qualified professional and submit a cleanup plan to address water quality issues before issuing the final order on October 17, 2024. For the purpose of this presentation, we will focus on the timeline after issuance of the final order, referenced here, the final CAO, as we are alleging the respondent for violation of the final order. The cleanup order contains several required actions as listed on this slide, but our complaint focuses on just two of them, listed here in bold. Submittal of completion report of winterization within 30 days of the order, and submittal of the proposed cleanup plan by April 15, 2025, which will be further detailed on the next slides. Required action one of the order requires submittal of a completion report of winterization within 30 days of issuance of the order. The report shall include, but is not limited to, a description of actions, photo documentation, and receipts of any waste disposal. Required action two requires submittal of a cleanup plan by April 15, 2025. The cleanup plan shall include, but is not limited to, an assessment of impacts, a plan for restoration, a proposal for compensatory mitigation, and an implementation schedule. Now that we have briefly introduced the required actions that are subject to our complaint, let's review a timeline of the respondent's performance after issuance of the final order. On October 17, 2024, the respondent replied to an email transmittal of the final order, thus confirming receipt, and stated he will clean up as his time and finances allow. On October 18, 2024, I responded to the respondent by clarifying the scope of the order and reiterating its requirements and deadlines. I received no response. On November 17, 2024 was the deadline for required action one. On December 2, 2024, I contacted the respondent via email to check on the status of submittal of required action one of the order and to inform the respondent that the deadline for required action one had passed, but I received no response again.
Could I ask you to speak up a little more?
Okay. Close that, okay. On December 12, 2024, I transmitted a notice of violation for failure to comply with required action one of the order, but I received no response. On December 27, 2024, the respondent the property sale was recorded with Mendocino County Assessor's Officer. And on December 31st, 2024, I contacted the respondent via email requesting an alternative mailing address after mail transmittal of our notice of violation returned, but I received no response again. Next. On April 14, 2025, I contacted the respondent via email to check on the status of submittal of required action two of the order, which was due on April 15, 2025. I also indicated that the North Coast Water Board has knowledge of the sale of the property and notified the respondent that he is still responsible for complying with the order, but I received no response again. On April 23, 2025, I transmitted a notice of violation for failure to comply with required action two of the order. Again, I received no response. On May 16, 2025, staff mailed the complaint to the respondent at his PO box on file. And on May 17, 2025, the respondent was The complaint was delivered through the respondent's PO box. And on May 23rd, 2025, I emailed a copy of the complaint to the respondent, and I received no response to either the mailed or emailed complaint transmittals. For violation one, we are alleging the respondent violated Water Code Section 13 to 67 by failing to submit completion report of winterization by November 17, 2024, per required action one of the order. Days of violation are alleged through April 15, 2025, the date of the deadline for submission of the cleanup plan, for a total of 149 days. For violation two, we are alleging the respondent violated Water Code Section 13 to 67 by failing to submit a cleanup plan by April 15, 2025 per required action number two of the order. Days of violation are alleged through May 1, 2025, the day the prosecution team was preparing the complaint, for a total of 16 days. For both alleged violations, Water Code Section 13 to 68 allows administrative civil liability up to $1,000 per day of violation. I will now give you a brief overview of our application of the penalty methodology, but we are happy to answer any questions the board may have about the details. In determining the total base liability, staff applied enforcement policies penalty calculation methodology. Steps 1 and 2 of the methodology are not applicable to this case, since we are alleging non-discharge violations for violations of required actions of an order. In step 3, staff considered a potential for harm score of major and a deviation from requirement of major and per day factor of 0.85 for both violations 1 and 2. This is consistent with the enforcement policy for violations of an existing order, and it's consistent with other recent enforcement actions taken by the board. Staff recommends a full collapsing of days from 149 days to 38 days for violation 1 and no collapsing days for violation 2, as the other days alleged are less than 30 days. Staff calculated the initial liability to be $32,300 for violation 1 and $13,600 for violation 2. In step 4, the enforcement policy requires Water Board to consider adjustment of factors based on violator's conduct. For culpability and cleanup and cooperation, despite compliance assistance provided by staff, the respondent failed to comply with the required actions and deadlines contained in the cleanup order. Similarly, failed to cooperate with staff or take any actions to resolve these violations. Thus, a value of 1.25 is appropriate for both of these factors. By multiplying values in steps 3 and 4, staff calculated the total base liability to be $71,000, $718, and 75 cents. The North Coast Water Board incurred $6,423 and 81 cents in staff costs associated with this enforcement action. However, the prosecution team exercised its discretion not to assess the costs against the respondent. Under step 8, I searched publicly available information to determine the respondent's ability to pay. Public records show the respondent sold the property on December 27, 2024 for $275,000. Additionally, Humboldt County tax assessor's records indicate that the respondent solely owned one property in Humboldt County and co-owns another one. The value of each of these property exceeds the proposed liability amount. The respondent had the opportunity throughout this proceeding to provide financial information to raise and substantiate an inability to pay but failed to do so. Based on the information available, the prosecution team proposed no adjustment to the total base liability amount for violations 1 and 2 under this step. This table shows the minimum calculated and maximum liability amounts. The proposed liability for violation 1 is $50,468.75, which is between the minimum and maximum allowed liability amount. The calculated liability for violation 2 exceeds maximum amount allowed and was adjusted to $16,000 to reflect the statutory maximum amount. After adjusting violation 2 to reflect the maximum liability amount, the final liability amount for both violations was calculated to be $66,468.75. The prosecution team requests that the board adopt the proposed order today imposing this liability amount against the respondent. This concludes our prepared remarks, and we are happy to answer any questions the board may have.
Board members, any questions?
Yeah, Mr. Chair. Yes, I'm looking back, and I'm seeing that on October 17th, 2024, that you did get a response from the respondent, and I believe it says, stated he will clean up as his time and finances allow. And since that time, have you received any responses from Mr. Harding at all?
No.
So he's been totally silent.
Yeah.
That's all I need to know. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Well, it seems cut and dry to me. For someone to not respond to repeated inquiries or your communications, you've gone above and beyond what possibly other agencies would have done in their procedures. Shall we? Yeah, and I would like to.
They have a closing statement too, probably.
Yeah.
Actually, my question is for legal counsel and our advisory team. The fact that the property is sold, the sale price is no longer in escrow. What options does this board have to, if we choose to adopt this order, what options do we have available to us to leverage payment of the violations?
So if the board were to adopt this administrative civil liability today, and the respondent did not pay the penalty, we could proceed with converting that to a money judgment in court, and it's a fairly ministerial process. Once we obtain that civil money judgment, the board could attempt to put liens on Mr. Harding's properties and any personal property, actually, for that matter, to try to recover the amount of that judgment, whatever amount the board ultimately adopts. If it adopts the order as proposed, $66,000, the money judgment would be for $66,000. That would be a civil judgment against Mr. Harding and would follow him, I believe it's 10 years before renewal.
And Does this board need to take any separate action to begin that process with you to go to the courts, do the administrative thing, and then to submit the liens on the property?
The board doesn't need to take any additional action. It's done as a relatively routine procedure in administrative civil liability cases where payment isn't received. We proceed to that step of obtaining
And would you take the lead on that?
It's either advisory or in some recent cases, the Office of Enforcement has taken that lead. And so once it's a final order of the board, we can work together and sort that out in terms of who takes the lead and completes that process.
The adoption of the order assumes that those other steps will be taken, however it's worked out between your office and legal counsel's office.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that adoption of the order necessarily assumes that, because the board, the executive officer, always has the discretion to decide not to proceed to that step. So it's discretionary, but it is typically, unless there's some extenuating circumstances or some reason why we wouldn't want to proceed with obtaining the money.
And that would be the exception to the rule.
Say that would be the exception to the rule.
That's what I'm trying to get at. Yeah. Is it automatic, or does this board have to do anything special?
No.
Okay, thank you.
I don't think we need one.
Anything you want to discuss about this?
Just for the record, Mr. Chair, there does not appear to be anybody representing Mr. Harding or Mr. Harding himself. Just wanted to make sure that it's on the record that nobody is present to represent the person against whom this proposed order is issued. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And nobody has signed up to make a public comment on this item either.
Chair Bedoya, just a reminder for your microphone when you speak.
I'll make a motion to approve administrative civil liability complaint number R1-2025-0022 issued to Michael Harding for $66,468.75.
Is there a second?
I'll second that, Mr. Chair.
Deidre, please.
Board Member McKenzie?
Aye.
Board Member Sundberg?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hart?
Aye.
Chair Bedoya?
Aye.
Board Member Giusti?
Aye.
I want to just say, Kaysen, probably hearkening back to my May comments of telling you guys to be bold, I'm very thrilled. So good job, team. Keep it up.
Thank you, Vice Chair Hart.
Prosecution team, thank you so much. And
well done, team.
We'll take a 15-minute break. Resume at 10:30. Welcome back. The board will now hold a workshop on the draft action plan for the Gualala River watershed. Sediment total, maximum daily load, and draft staff report supporting the Gualala River Sediment TMDL Action Plan. The action plan is a proposed amendment to the Water Quality Control Plan for the North Coast region. This workshop takes place during the formal public comment period for the draft action plan and staff report, which ends on August 25, 2025. The purpose of this workshop is to provide information to the board and the public regarding the action plan and to provide opportunity for oral comments from members of the public and interested parties. No formal board action will be taken, although board members may have questions or provide general direction to staff. While the board will hear oral comments at this time, comments should be submitted in writing to ensure that the board has the complete comment for review and response, we will begin this item with a staff presentation and invite oral comments from the public on the draft staff report and action plan. The timeline for the presentations are as follows. One, for staff, 45 minutes. Two, for oral comments, 5 minutes each. And three, for board questions. Board member questions and comments other than questions clarifying the material being presented should be held until after the staff presentations or until there's a break in the presentation for questions. At this time, we will start with the staff presentation.
Thank you. Good morning, members of the board and Chair Bedoya. I am Dr. Lance Lay, a water resource control engineer in the Watershed Assessment and Recovery Unit within the Planning and Watershed Stewardship Division. For today's workshop, I will be discussing the draft action plan for the Walla River Sediment Total Maximum Daily Load, draft staff report for the action plan, and the related documents that are part of this item's agenda package. This presentation is
Dr. Lee, could you mind moving the mic forward a little bit?
Okay.
Closer.
Better?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Thank
great.
You.
So this presentation is split into three sections. First, I will be providing the regulatory and historical background to this TMDL action plan. Second, I will summarize the TMDL that was established by US EPA in 2001, including the various elements of a typical TMDL. In the last section, I will go over the action plan elements itself. So the purpose of today's workshop is to provide opportunity to the public as well as to members of the board to give feedback to staff regarding the draft action plan and its supporting documents. The public comment and review period for the draft documents started on July 11th, which ends in about 2 weeks on August 25th. An important point that will be reiterated throughout the presentation is that the draft action plan implements the US EPA TMDL established in 2001. The draft action plan relies on the existing science and technical analyses conducted by North Coast Water Board staff in support of the 2001 TMDL. The rationale for retaining the existing science will be discussed later in this presentation. Section 303D of the Federal Clean Water Act requires that states identify water bodies that do not meet water quality standards. States must then establish a total maximum daily load for those impaired water bodies and their pollutants. From the perspective of US EPA and the water boards, this requirement has already been met with the establishment of the sediment TMDL in 2001. With respect to state law, the California Water Code authorizes the North Coast Water Board to develop and adopt implementation plans to address impaired water bodies so that they meet water quality objectives. At a minimum, adopted implementation plans require descriptions of actions, a schedule, and a monitoring plan. The draft action plan for the Guadalupe River Sediment TMDL meets these California Water Code requirements. This distinction between state and federal law is important to highlight because of the multiple TMDLs established by US EPA for the North Coast region. That a TMDL exists does not mean that every TMDL requires its own action plan to be adopted into the basin plan. So why have an action plan now? We'll take a step back and look at the regulatory history of the Cuyallala River. In 1994, the watershed was listed as impaired due to excessive sedimentation and siltation. This impairment listing was further bolstered by local coho and steelhead salmon populations being listed as endangered or threatened under the Federal Endangered Species Act in 1996 and 2000, respectively. Also in 1996, a lawsuit was brought by the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations and other entities against the State Water Board. The judgment from the lawsuit led to a consent decree, which is a court order that directed US EPA to develop TMDLs for all sediment-impaired water bodies in the North Coast region. The Guadalupe River watershed was included in this consent decree. North Coast Water Board staff at the time provided scientific and technical support that led to the sediment TMDO approved by US EPA in 2001. Following the multiple consent decree TMDLs, the sediment TMDO implementation policy was adopted into the basin plan. The purpose of the sediment TMDO implementation policy was to serve as the action plan for the TMDLs established during the consent decree. Now, fast forward to the 2020s, another lawsuit was brought forward by the Friends of the Gualala River against the water boards. The lawsuit was resolved through an agreement with Friends of the Gualala River, wherein the North Coast Water Board will develop an action plan for controlling sediment in the Gualala River. Pursuant to this agreement, the North Coast Water Board staff initiated the public process for adopting the Gualala River Action Plan into the basin plan, with CEQA scoping conducted in 2024, and now the public review and comment period in 2025. With this timeline in mind, the next several slides will cover the period for the TMDL itself. While the TMDL was established in 2001, the draft action plan itself contains the US EPA TMDL. For some basic background, elements of a TMDL as required by the Clean Water Act and federal regulations include a problem statement, which identifies the water body, its characteristics, and the water quality standards being violated due to a pollutant. It requires a source analysis that quantifies the sources of pollution, both natural, background, and anthropogenic. Load and waste load allocations for non-point source and point source pollution, respectively, which assign numeric values to individual sources. These load allocations provide the loading capacity of a water body, where if they are exceeded, water quality standards would be impaired. And other elements include the targets and indicators, both numeric and narrative, that describe the desired conditions, which would signify the attainment of water quality standards. Load allocations must also consider margin of safety, seasonal variations, and critical conditions, which together characterize the uncertainty and natural variability affecting the source analysis and load allocation estimates. Finally, the TMDL must document public participation showing engagement between the regulatory agency with the public and parties affected by the TMDL. So for the next several slides, I will focus on the problem statement, source analysis, load allocations, and targets and indicators for this TMDL. The first part of the problem statement is the watershed setting. The Gualala River watershed is a coastal watershed found in northern Sonoma and southern Mendocino counties. 75% of the watershed is forested lands, with grass and shrublands accounting for most of the remainder. The majority in land use in the watershed has historically has been timberlands, which comprise about 39% of the watershed, with other economic activities being ranching and vineyards. Urban development is a very small fraction of the watershed at 2.5%. That said, there are extensive road networks that support these land uses, with over 1,500 road miles across the watershed, or approximately 5 road miles per square mile. These road networks intersect with the 1,000 plus miles of streams, resulting in a little over 1,500 stream crossings. So on this slide, we have the watershed's land cover distribution in 2001 and in 2022, based on the National Land Cover Data Set, which is a remote sensing product produced by a consortium of public agencies. The 2022 land cover map shows a slight increase in forest lands since 2001. Aside from this forest cover difference, the land cover changes between 2001 and 2022 have been minimal. This fact is important to highlight because this relative lack of change supports the use of the scientific and technical analysis in the 2001 TMDL to the present day draft action plan. On this slide are the water quality objectives addressed by the TMDL. Water quality objectives may be numeric or narrative, and they provide the basis to judge whether the beneficial uses of water are being supported. The parameters or pollutants relevant for the sediment TMDL include suspended material, settleable material, sediment, and turbidity. For suspended material, settleable material, and sediment, the objectives are narrative. Water bodies shall not contain these pollutants in amounts that cause nuisance or adversely affect beneficial uses. The turbidity objective is partially narrative. Turbidity shall not exceed 20% above natural background levels. Excessive sediment in the Gualla River watershed has impaired the following beneficial uses: cold freshwater habitat, commercial or sport fishing, estuarine habitat, migration of aquatic organisms, and spawning, reproduction, and/or early development of aquatic organisms. We will focus on cold freshwater habitat, or cold, as that beneficial use is the most sensitive, as evidenced by the threatened status of coho and steelhead salmonids. Specific effects of the excessive sedimentation and turbidity on salmonids include fine sediment adversely affecting rearing habitat, damage to fish gills, reduced feeding rates, reduced growth rates, and ultimately increased mortality. The source analysis for the 2001 sediment TMDL relied on aerial photography analysis, sampling for field measurements of sediment sources, in-stream surveys, and an assessment of sediment delivery on public and private roads. Data for the source analysis span 1978 to 2000. Specific sediment processes that contribute to pollution include debris slides, debris flows, earth flows, soil creep, gullies, stream crossing, washouts and diversions, road surface erosion, and skid trail surface erosion. The pie chart on the left sums individual sediment sources into the broad categories of natural backgrounds, timber harvest-related sources, and road-related sources. The source analysis found that approximately 31% of sediment sources come from natural backgrounds, 11% come from timber harvest-related activities, and the remainder and majority being road-related sources at 58%. The pie chart on the right are load allocations and load reductions. To meet the attainment of water quality standards, the percent reductions needed are 89% for timber harvest-related sources and 85% for road-related sources. The watershed-wide TMDL is the sum of the right pie chart and is equal to 475 tons per square mile per year.
Question?
Yes. Lance.
So just to be clear, these were the conditions in 2001 that served as the basis for the TMDL at the time?
Yes.
These are not today's conditions?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
To meet the load allocation and load reductions, the US EPA TMDL describes various numeric targets and indicators. These targets and indicators serve as guideposts for monitoring and implementation purposes. They are categorized into in-stream and hill slope targets. Hill slope targets are the outcome of source control, that is, through the implementation of permits and other regulatory tools. In-stream targets are more response-based, which are the eventual consequence of restoration activity and source control. The TMDL also divides each category into three time scales: short-term, mid-term, and long-term. Short-term typically means every few years. Mid-term is based on episodic events of varying frequencies, and long-term is on the order of decades. So that concludes the 2001 TMDL. The TMDL and the associated load allocations have not changed because the source analysis and loading capacity have not changed. That said, between 2001 and 2023, there have been activities conducted in the watershed that address the TMDL load reductions. For the North Coast Water Board, these activities include the permitting mechanisms and other regulatory actions for timber and road sources. The exact permits and adopted will be listed on a later slide. In 2005, the sediment TMDL implementation policy was adopted into the basin plan. The implementation policy was developed in part to address the consent decree or US EPA established TMDLs, including the Gualla River sediment TMDL. The implementation policy directs staff to use existing regulatory authority and in issuing permits and enforcement actions, as well as in pursuing non-regulatory actions such as working with public agencies and nonprofits to develop sediment control strategies. Additionally, a recently adopted Basin Plan Amendment project reorganized and remediated the Basin Plan sections so that it now explicitly references the US EPA TMDLs and their relationship with the sediment TMDL implementation policy. Other activities in or relevant to the watershed include the improvement and evolution of management practices as documented in the California Forest Practice Rules by CAL FIRE and the Rural Roads Handbook by Pacific Watershed Associates. They include sediment control projects for roads on private property in the watershed and grant-funded restoration and monitoring work. One of these grant-funded projects included in-stream habitat and water quality monitoring by the Guadalajara River Watershed Council. The Watershed Council has been a key partner during the development of the action plan. As early as 1998, the Watershed Council has collected in-stream data up to 2023. The distribution of monitoring locations in the most recent year of available data are shown in the figure. Majority of these locations are in the northern portion of the watershed because because Guadalajara River Industries, now known as Guadalajara River Timber, provided landowner access to the Watershed Council. The monitoring data parameters are consistent with the in-stream numeric targets and indicators in the TMDL, and they include habitat surveys for coho and steelhead salmon, pebble counts to characterize sediment particle size distribution, stream bed variation, which is a proxy for habitat complexity, channel elevation, and large woody debris. The Watershed Council and timber companies have provided staff with these data, which we have assessed and documented in an appendix to the draft staff report. So despite the long data record, only 4 monitoring locations showed any statistically significant trends. That is, they are trend results which have low probability of being random chance. The location of these trends are the Little North Fork, Dry Creek, South Fork near the main stem, and Big Pepperwood Creek. In red font color are trends that are contrary to desired in-stream target, and in blue font color are trend results that are consistent with desired targets. D50, or the median particle size, has been decreasing in some locations while increasing in others. Channel bed elevation shows a similar disagreement between the stations. The D50 and channel bed elevation results suggest that the sediment may be moving through the system, but it's not clear yet what the overall picture looks like. Some positive signs include large woody debris counts across all sites shown in the figure, in large part due to restoration activity. Station 217 near the South Fork and main stem also show increasing stream bed variation and increasing steelhead salmon counts. Again, these results aren't conclusive as they are isolated to 4 locations relatively close to one another as compared to the total geographic scope of the monitoring data, which also mostly covers the northern portion of the watershed. In general, sediment-impaired watersheds require timescales on the order of decades to a century or more to fully meet water quality objectives. Likewise, data to measure progress towards these objectives also require long time scales. While the results shown here show some promise, it's important to acknowledge that that watershed-wide response and trends will take more time to appear. Now we'll move to the last third of the presentation, where we will focus on the draft action plan. As stated when this timeline graphic was introduced, this watershed-specific TMDL action plan is part of a stipulated agreement with Friends of the Guadalajara River. Before moving on, I'll take a pause here if there are any questions from board members. Hearing none? Okay, thank you. So the development of the action plan, or the draft action plan, started with the premise that there would be no new source analysis, as the technical work and TMDL are still valid today. Specifically, the load allocations remain valid as they're the benchmark for meeting water quality objectives. The lack of conclusive findings from the in-stream data assessment and minor change in land cover supports this premise. What is new, however, is an emphasis on roads and road-related sediment. The figure on this slide shows the percent impervious surface in 2001 and 2022. Impervious surface can be used as a proxy for urban infrastructure development, including roads. An increase of 11.7% impervious surface between 2001 and 2022 indicates that roads remain an issue and a continued source of sediment discharge. Note, impervious surface is not an ideal proxy for roads as they are more representative of paved surfaces rather than rural roads, which can be dirt or gravel lined. So the draft action plan incorporates directly by reference or summarizes many components of the 2001 TMDL. These existing components include the problem statement, the source analysis, the load allocations, the numeric watershed-wide TMDL, and the monitoring for targets and indicators. The main new component for not in the 2001 TMDL is a watershed-wide specific program of implementation. The draft action plan's program of implementation can be summarized in a brief statement. It relies on existing permits and the development of a new watershed-wide roads-focused permit to fill in the regulatory gaps. The table on this slide shows all the existing permits as well as a new proposed permit at the bottom. Each permit row shows the responsible party, their covered activity, and the sediment sources addressed by the permit. The timber harvest waste discharge requirements, or WDRs, and waivers of WDRs on non-federal lands address all sediment source categories found on timberlands, both roads-related and harvest-related.
Another question while you've got the slide up, Lance. So yes. Just to be clear, the draft action plan will not affect any of the existing programs. Won't make any changes there. The bold lettering is the bottom. The big change is what will be proposed for rural roads.
Correct.
But everything else remains the same.
Yes.
Thank you.
Where was I? So the 5-county or 5C waiver covers roads related sediment from county-owned roads. The Caltrans stormwater permit covers state highways and other Caltrans-owned infrastructure. The construction stormwater general permit covers land disturbance, including roads for projects exceeding 1 acre. General water quality certification covers projects adjacent to water bodies. The recently adopted vineyard order covers sediment discharge from roads on vineyard lands. The new permit addresses the remaining gap of all other privately owned roads, including the roads on timberlands not enrolled in active timber harvest plans.
I'm sorry, I got another one for you. When we talk about privately held roads, is that for both profit and non-profit landowners?
I believe so.
It has to be.
Yes.
Lance, can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Do you know how much federal land is in that big footprint compared to private?
Federal lands, I think it's fairly small, if I understand correctly. I don't think I can answer that question right now.
Okay, thank you.
So next, I'll go over the conceptual details of the new permit that is in the early stages of development, referred to as the Guayala Roads Permit. Please note that these details are preliminary and subject to change through our public outreach and engagement process. As mentioned previously, the purpose of the Guayala Roads Permit is to address sediment discharges from private rural roads not covered by other existing permits in the watershed. The permit would require all landowners and in the watershed to maintain their roads to reduce erosion and sediment runoff into waterways. The proposed permit may require landowners with 1,000 acres or more, or those with roads that pose a significant risk to water quality, to have additional requirements. such as inventorying and assessing their roads and stream crossings, prioritizing areas for repairs, repairing sediment sources on their roads, monitoring and reporting on their progress, and maintaining their roads to prevent future erosion. Staff are currently focused on engaging with affected landowners and community members to inform the draft permit. Staff anticipate completing the draft permit by summer 2026 and proposing a permit for adoption consideration by fall 2026.
Mr. Chair, if I could just ask, are these proposed conditions on the new permit roads, are they similar to conditions that are in existence for that have been previously imposed on the rest of the roads? Existing permits, in other words, existing road permits.
Yeah, thanks. I can help answer that. Good morning, Chair Bedoya, members of the board. Devin Rabolino, senior engineering geologist of your staff. I supervise the watershed assessment and recovery unit that is in part overseeing the development of this new permit. So as Lance mentioned, just a caveat that we are in the really early stages of developing this permit, so a lot of these details are preliminary. But as far as what we're contemplating, and as far as the requirements or the preliminary requirements you see here on the screen to inventory, assess, prioritize, and treat roads, that is consistent with many of our other road-related permits throughout the region. Very similar format to the federal lands permit, which was adopted last year. Many of our private timber, industrial and non-industrial permits as well.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much.
All right. So while the details of the compliance costs for the new permit are being determined, as the content of the permit is still under development, the draft staff report does list funding sources and assistance organizations, which are repeated here on this slide. Grant funding in particular can vary very widely in focus, funding amounts, and eligibility. They are subject to changes in the funding entity's priorities and are generally more available to organizations versus individual landowners. Private landowners can still seek assistance on road-related projects from resource conservation districts, entities within the North Coast Resource Partnership, and the watershed-wide roads assessment currently funded through water board contracts. One of these contracts, which has already been executed, is with the Sonoma Resource Conservation District. This slide documents the extent of North Coast Water Board outreach efforts and public participation in the development of the draft action plan, as well as the beginning of engagement of the new Gualala Roads permit, which began this spring. For the action plan development, CEQA scoping meetings, both virtual and in person, occurred last summer within the watershed. Tribal outreach was conducted to tribal entities per AB 52 requirements on tribal consultation. The public notice for the draft action plan and draft staff report were sent out to 180 recipients via the Gov Delivery email service. Additionally, staff have engaged with interested entities in the watershed, including tribes, nonprofits, industry, and individual landowners. The right column shows some of the outreach and engagement we've done to support both the action plan and the developing Gualala Roads permit. Since October 2023, we have published eight project status updates on the development of the action plan and Gualala Roads permit. Staff have met with affected landowners, tribes, environmental groups, industry, and other community members. As our team develops the draft permit over the next year, we will continue to prioritize engagement with affected landowners and interested parties in the watershed. Overall, the draft action plan is relatively straightforward. The key takeaways for this presentation are that the action plan implements the USCPA TMDL without introducing any new science related to the source analysis. Staff's decision to retain the existing analysis is supported by data and information that shows minimal change in land cover and land use between the TMDL's establishment and the present day. The action plan relies on existing permits to address the majority of sediment sources identified in the TMDL. And the only new component is the requirement for the North Coast Water Board to develop a watershed-wide roads permit that addresses sources not covered by existing permits. While the new Gualla Roads permit is a requirement in the action plan, the permit and its adoption would be a board action separate from the action plan. As for staff's next steps in the Basin Plan Amendment Project, as noted previously, the public comment and review period ends on August 25th. After the public comment period ends, staff will consider public comments and revise the draft action plan and draft staff report as necessary. A board adoption hearing is scheduled for December 4th or 5th of this year. The proposed action plan, the final staff report, and a response to comments document are expected as part of the December board meeting agenda package posted on the North Coast Water Board website. Once adopted by the North Coast Water Board, staff expect the State Water Board approval hearing in 2026, then approval by Office of Administrative Law in late 2026 or early 2027. After Office of Administrative Law approval, the action plan will formally become part of the Basin Plan. Parties interested in receiving email updates on the permit or the action plan status can subscribe to the Gov Delivery Service. Registration is available on the North Coast Water Board website. The web address can be accessed online via the link provided on the screen. We encourage all participants who wish to receive future notifications to sign up for this email list. The image on the right side of this slide shows the available subscription options on the North Coast Water Board website, with a box checked for Gualla River Watershed TMDL. For additional information on either the action plan or the new roads permit, please contact the individuals listed on this slide. Thank you.
Lance, thank you so much for that very detailed project. To you, thank you, and to your team. Deirdre, are there any people out in the public, any oral commenters?
No.
Okay, board members, do you have any questions?
Mr. Chair, I find it very interesting under key takeaways at the very end of slide number 26, available monitoring data collected, and that is over the last 25 years, shows limited changes or improvements in in-stream conditions. And that is after permit conditions have been required on most of the sources of sediment in this watershed. Existing permits address majority of sediment sources identified in the TMDL. And then the roads permit is an early development, but as I asked in my question, it's going to be pretty similar to the conditions that have previously been applied. It seems to me, as the newest member on the board, that we've labored mightily over these past 25 years, but we cannot anticipate any improvement over the condition of the waters in the Gualla watershed. Now, can somebody correct me on that statement?
Well, I think the anticipation of change is implementing this road maintenance program.
Chair Bedoya, may I address
please
the comment?
I can talk about the data assessment. So like I mentioned, it takes quite a long time for significant trends to show up in sediment-impaired watersheds. There have been some positive trends in some portions of the watershed, which I've shown on the presentation, but overall, it would take a much longer time scale.
So approving an ultimate action plan, then we're talking 10 years, 20 years, 30 years out to see restoration of salmonid populations. I'm just interested in when we could actually expect to see improvements as a result of putting an action plan in place. Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem to have happened up until this time.
Yes, yeah, so Board Member McKenzie, a couple of points to address your question. So the first is that I think from Lance's presentation, it showed that the majority of sediment production was actually from roads which aren't currently covered on any under any permit, right? So this watershed, the largest source, has not been addressed over the last 20 years. So that's part of the issue, and what this action plan and the future permit will be driven towards trying to resolve. The other one, and you know, the way I've heard it said, and I think is the easiest to understand, is that it unfortunately takes humans a very short period of time to unravel a watershed, and a very long time for it to recover. And so from our best studied watersheds in the region, you know, we've had data for, you know, extensive data for 20 years, control for 20 years, and are just starting to see those changes come up in the data. And so we do expect it to take decades, unfortunately.
Okay. Fair enough.
And just one more note to add about, you know, you mentioned the recovery of salmonid populations specifically, and just want to note that those fisheries are it's a complex beneficial use, and we need to do what we can do to support that beneficial use through water quality efforts. But there are also a lot of other conditions that are at play when it comes to salmonid population recovery, such as stream flow, which is more under the purview of State Water Board, Division of Water Rights, and then issues related to ocean conditions, which are a whole other ball of wax. So just wanted to note that as we see water quality recovery, there may not be a direct linear relationship with salmonid population recovery, given those other factors at play.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I have to support Mr. McKenzie's view. When I had my briefing yesterday, I calculated it closer to 30 years of effort, and I think about the time, and thank you, Lance, that was an excellent presentation, but I think about the time, the effort, the monies that have been spent, because, you know, the goal is water quality, but the prize is fish. That's what's driving all of this in this particular case, right? We want more fish in these streams. When we talk about the rural roads permit specifically, since this watershed covers both Mendocino and Sonoma counties, that won't matter, will it? There are no jurisdictional boundaries in this case. The proposed roads permit will apply to the watershed regardless of the political jurisdiction which it lies.
That's correct.
That's good. Thank you. The other thing that struck me, that actually hurt me when I was going over my, this is, I'm referring now to information that was in the Gualala River Sediment Action Plan, Environmental Quality Act draft environmental checklist, and you used information from the Gualala Watershed Group for the fish, I see. On page 7 of this document, as part of the Gualala River Watershed Monitoring Data Assessment. Powerful document. It shows that coho salmon have not been observed in the Gualala watershed since 2004. Coho salmon are on a strict 3-year life cycle. That means every 3 years you have a returning generation. There's lots of 3-year blocks since 2004. If this data is accurate, and I'm not saying it's not, what I'm saying it's very troubling, is that these fish have been extirpated from the river. I mean, that's what this data is telling me. There's no recovery here. It's resuscitation. It's trying to get them back. And the only way they're going to come back, if there's no base population or base stocks, is from recruitment of strays. That there are so many fish, they're looking for places to go. And that is really quite disturbing. I'm hoping on the following page, where the same efforts have shown recurring occurrence of steelhead in the river, I could just hope that some of those steelhead were misidentified and that some of them are actually coho salmon. I mean, that's our best bet, right? It's like, okay, we're out there measuring eyes. Coho salmon have bigger eyes than steelhead. I mean, little stuff. And I'm assuming that these numbers are based on juveniles, not necessarily adults, because I didn't see any mention of carcass counts or anything like that. But that's our best bet, that somebody out there counting steelhead misidentified some of them as coho salmon, because they will overlap when they come in. But this data is really disturbing because they're gone. This is just me talking here, but just a wording accuracy. There's no such thing as a steelhead salmon. I see that used a couple times. It's a steelhead trout. It's an ocean-run rainbow trout. The difference between trout and salmon is trout don't die after they spawn. So using those, and again, we want these documents to be clean. So just saying steelhead is fine or steelhead trout, but steelhead salmon is a misuse of those two terms. They're talking about two completely different organisms. But, I mean, on one hand, I really applaud you for all the work you're doing on this. On the other hand, I mean, you just threw a wet blanket over me. I mean, it's really disturbing to see that after 30 years of so much effort, so much money, so much energy, we're not seeing any improvement in some of these. So I'm hopeful. I'm going to support this, obviously, and it's the last thing we can do, essentially, in terms of affecting anthropogenic inputs of sediment. So we got to hope, I guess, is what I'm saying. But I thank you for all this. Just a lot of stuff floating around in my head as I go through this incredibly thoughtful and thought-provoking document. So thank you for that.
Yeah, and thank you for your comments. I did want to note that, the assessment did highlight some improvements. And while those improvements we might not be able to, see expressed throughout the watershed at this time, I think it is good to note, and in relation to the fact that we have had, for example, permits for timber harvest activities in the watershed for a couple decades now. And so I think that the effort that those permits require to control sediment from those activities, is needed and is also supporting us in the right direction.
Oh, I'm not asking you to defend yourself. Please defend this agency, because I look at those lists of existing programs. If this agency wasn't doing it, who would be? Would there be any improvement, even marginal improvement? So, I mean, I think this agency is in the right place, in the right space. I don't want you to back down from it. Like I said, with this road-related permit, hopefully we'll close that one gap. But that was the other thing that I was struck by me. It's like, well, if we're not doing it, who would be? So, I applaud this agency for taking the lead, taking the lumps. I know back when this started, there were a lot of lumps being taken by people in this agency for being out in front and challenging other agencies to address their responsibilities, especially back in the timber days. So, no, it's all good, but it's not as good. But the results are not, what I think we all hope for.
If thank you all for your presentation. I do have a question. Stocking fish at whatever age the fish is, whether it's a smolt or an adult, by our hatcheries, it's a Band-Aid to fix or to try to improve situations, populations in some rivers and tributaries. Is there ever a mitigation factor when you're giving out permits or when permits are given to timber harvesting companies? Can they do a mitigation by financing stocking tributaries or rivers? Is that ever done in any area of our region?
I don't believe so, Chair Bedoya. I think if it's done, it's done in a voluntary way. Our permits don't require it. There's no mitigation required for timber harvest activities. It's separate and different than like a 401 certification where someone, you know, does work in stream. That requires some sort of mitigation, but the timber harvest process doesn't require mitigation. And that's not really controlled by us. That's due to the laws that are set forth and how they're regulated through the
forces. Just thinking of a creative tool to increase the populations.
Yeah. Yeah, for ones where they're like extirpated, I think it would have to be a reintroduction, and there have been efforts to do that in other areas. Jonathan Warmerdam would know a lot more. Jake Shannon of our staff would know more about that. I know Jonathan's participated in some of those collections and redistributions of fish. But I'd say
if there's any opportunity to explore this detail in any of our region, addressing any extirpated population or dwindling population, I think we should look into it.
I'll check in with Jonathan. I know that work is done, and I'm not sure where, and I'm guessing there's a pretty strong effort to determine the best locations that have the best opportunities for them to recover and continue forward. And
whether it's steelhead, salmon, coho, or even the sucker that's in decline.
Understood. I'll check with him. Thanks.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Alex, Board Member Hart has her hand raised on Zoom.
Alex?
Yeah, thank you. I'll just be brief. I just want to thank work on this. I know it's a really big ticket item, and a lot of work goes on behind the scenes. I want to make sure that in the language in this, in the development this document and everything, I mean, fish are the hot thing. I get it. Everywhere in our region. But beneficial uses is not just about fish. We need to make sure we're addressing everything, and don't pigeonhole yourself and focusing in on that language. You can open yourself up. I mean, to other groups kind of coming after, it appears that we're focusing in on that, and we're kind of doing the work a little bit of some of the other departments, and we need to make sure the beneficial uses is for other things too besides fish. There are other species that depend on clean waters and clean habitats, so just careful with getting too focused in on utilizing coho, steelhead, you name it. That's all. I don't know if that's making sense, but it's just...
Thank you.
Jake, is your microphone?
Oh, sorry. One thing that struck me, the Gualla River Watershed Monitoring Data Assessment Report is the last report that's in our package. And when you come to the very end and under data gaps, due to the limitations in spatial and temporal data, it is difficult to come to conclusions as to whether in-stream conditions across the watershed as a whole are trending in positive or negative directions. Watershed-wide trends could not be tested due to the lack of spatial distribution and frequency of monitoring stations in the watershed. So in terms of an action plan that will have the last gap filled by the this new roads permit, it would seem that the action plan also should address the conclusion that staff made under data gaps as we go forward. I really am concerned that if over the past 30 years that this is the conclusion to which we've arrived, then what's going to be any different in the next 30 years unless there's some changes made in monitoring? Now, I realize this is one watershed out of many in Region 1, but nonetheless, if we don't have some more accurate means of monitoring the impact of our regulation, then a board in the future is going to find themselves getting a similar report, unless there's accurate monitoring data. And I've had quite a bit of experience in evaluating the impact of regulations, albeit in pesticides and groundwater. You impose a regulation, and then as the years go by, you measure the impact of reduced residues of the pesticide in the groundwater. Requires monitoring. And so these particular two sentences under data gaps really caught my attention, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Your action plan, just to speak on that subject, your action plan does include monitoring and funding for monitoring.
So I think if I could address Jake's question first. So, you know, as Lance highlighted, there just needs to be additional time to be able to see the changes in sediment throughout the watershed, to be able to make those watershed-wide trends and conditions, although from the data that we do have, you know, things for the most part seem to look good. I also wanted to highlight that the TMDL includes both hill slope and in-stream indicators. And so part of what we can measure, you know, are the hill slope indicators through addressing sediment sources through our permits. And so the new permit that we are developing will focus on hill slope indicators. And will ensure that the sources of the sediment are the priority in addressing. And then, you know, potentially later at some time, maybe there's opportunity to explore, you know, in-stream conditions as well. But really the focus is on addressing the sources and, you know, those consistent with, you know, the hill slope indicators in the TMDL as guideposts.
Chair Bedoy, may I also?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I just want to add to be clear that the action plan itself does not include any funding that comes towards monitoring. And so your points are really important, and they're points that really are true for our entire region. And that, you know, watershed-wide monitoring, as I'm sure you know, is difficult, expensive. And when you're looking at trends, you're looking at decades of that monitoring being done. It's really difficult to do. And, you know, our monitoring funds at the region are quite small and are at the whim of the budget cycle for the state. And so we often have very little monitoring funds to put towards it. And so when we're looking at that type of monitoring, where we get that funding is always a difficult question. And so some of our permits required of the permittees. I don't think that's not currently being looked at in the permit that we're proposing, but at least
extensive in-stream monitoring, to be clear. But it's a difficult question for us to ask and a struggle we deal with every year due to the budget issues.
Mr. Chair, when I first joined this board, my observation was that this Region 1 was underfunded, under-resourced, and not able to perform all of these functions, which to me would seem to be essential, given your the analysis that I just quoted on data gaps. And so my function here as a board member, I will continue to point this out, and I also am politically astute enough to recognize the relationship we have to the mothership, the state board in Sacramento, and the government of the state of California. I'm not naive, but I do believe that we need to continue to point this out. Otherwise, as I said earlier, a board 30 years from now will be presented with the same conclusions because the monitoring data will not be there.
I think that description of our board applies to most regions of our state, and so our staff would be forced to leverage data gathered from other groups, and you list maybe 10 or more groups in your report. Potentially they're doing monitoring.
I acknowledge the paucity of resources, Mr. Chair. It's not the fault of the staff doing their work, but it's a system, obviously a system-wide problem. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you so much. Charge
Thank you.
Forward.
Thank you, dear.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
Okay, I'd like to take a pulse on the group. Should we break for lunch and close session and take on item number 5 afterwards? Or, yeah, how long would this take?
45 minutes, just on my presentation.
Do lunch.
I can...
How long is item number 5 going to take? If it's not going to take very long, why don't we get it out of the way and then break for lunch? That way the afternoon's kind of free.
Chair Bedoya, members of the board, presentation that I have for item 5 is about 45 minutes running just on my slides, and I'm hoping for a little bit of conversation and engagement. I assure you that if you go into that after lunch coma, I will wake you back up. But your call. I could go right now, or we could take a break.
Let's continue with item number 5.
Okay. Give me just a second to get the computer and set up. Thank you so much. Maybe a few-minute break. Thanks.
Okay. We're resuming the meeting. Up next is Jeremiah with item number 5. Please proceed.
Chair Bedoya, members of the board, it's a pleasure to be back in front of you today in an informational item setting. I am Jeremiah Puget, Senior Environmental Scientist, Supervisor of the Enforcement Unit, and your Regional Enforcement Coordinator. Do a little overview of today's presentation. I do expect these slides to run about 40, 45 minutes. I am hoping for some engagement from the board and some thoughts and feedback from you all and any members of the public that are in listening today. We're going to go over the enforcement policy, discuss the unit staffing and some partnerships. We're going to look at our existing priorities and a slight revision to those priorities that we're proposing for some clarification. We're also going to look at our performance targets as well as a summary of actions, things that have come before the board and some things that haven't come before the board in which we've done some good work that I think you'll be very pleased to hear updates on. And then we'll give you our plans for 25-26, that's the fiscal year that we're in, and then hopefully some engagement and feedback. But at any point in time, if you have a question, feel free to ask. Thanks.
Before we move on, I do just want to note that this has been part of your packet. It does have some terminology. I'm going to try to avoid the acronyms and speak in these more plain terms, but there's some definitions here. Also, as part of the packet, we decided to give you an appendix to the enforcement policy, which further elaborates some of the use of these tools, what they mean in the context and the authorities behind them. As a little bit of background, and the enforcement policy recommends that staff do seek input from the board and members of the public annually on our current enforcement priorities. And over the past few years, we've been implementing priorities with notable success. Our enforcement teams have come before the board with various issues and cases, from stormwater to timber, cannabis, and waste discharges to land, like the Race Station Winery cease and desist order that you heard last year. That's why we didn't give an update last year. We had our hands full with a priority of that order. I do have an update for you later in the presentation. The main point, again, is not only to give a progress report, but an opportunity to hear from you all. And I'll give you more details as we move on. It is worth mentioning that the enforcement policy was recently updated in 2024. There are a few substantive changes that I do want to highlight and point out in this iteration of the policy. A couple key changes: regional boards can now utilize a tool known as Cal EnviroScreen and other statutory tools and resources to determine a disadvantaged community status. That's really key for us in how we work through the policy with our small disadvantaged communities and how we engage with, how we engage with environmental justice, EJ communities, as well as the application of compliance projects and supplemental environmental projects. There has been some clarity on the application of those compliance projects, and there's been some procedural changes. As you've probably already noted, the prosecution teams now are back to issuing the hearing procedures in coordination with Office of Chief Counsel, and that's Nate and Bailey when she's back with us. So I'd like to cover the enforcement unit staff at this point. You've all had the opportunity to already meet Mr. Jordan Felak, who's come before you a few times, and Ms. Adona White has even served as advisor to the board in enforcement cases in the past. I'm excited to announce two new staff members. On the left, you see Monica Bueno. She's an environmental scientist in the enforcement unit. She's now been with us for 3 months. And in her second week, on the right, we have Erica Winter. And Erica comes to us from the California Department of Fish and Wildlife and will be working with us in our cannabis enforcement program. Monica comes from the Department of Cannabis Control, and she'll be working on office-wide enforcement and working with us on a lot of wastewater-related cases. Our unit is involved in multiple teams throughout the agency, and the enforcement program relies on these internal partnerships, good communication, and clarity on team roles and responsibilities, which vary from case to case. And in short, the enforcement unit is really a support unit, and we're here to provide technical expertise and support and procedures throughout all of the divisions that you see, from point source control and groundwater protection to non-point source and surface water protection. And we are housed in the agriculture and enforcement unit, and we do still communicate and have a lot of input as well and support from planning and stewardship. It's also important to acknowledge our partners in Sacramento, not just the Office of Enforcement Attorneys, who help us greatly, but first off, I really do want to acknowledge the staff over there. You've seen recent staff come before you, like in the time schedule order. Gary Dickinson is a staff member from the Office of Enforcement housed over in Sacramento, and not only do they have a team of very helpful attorneys that help us on cases, but a lot of technical staff that do inspections for us here throughout the region in multiple programs and help us achieve our goals. I do just want to, again, thank OE's legal department, and I'll give you some examples of that later on as they come in being helpful. Coming off of this morning's item, I want to thank you again, and coming back to the lien issue, they often help us out in achieving those, and I'll give you some status on a few of those projects as I move through today's presentation. This commercial break is brought to you by partnerships. We have a lot of them. And for example, when it comes to how do we get out on cannabis sites, well, we largely rely on the Department of Fish and Wildlife, who serve warrants that have local law enforcement, that have wardens that we go out with. We go out with the Department of Fish and Wildlife, water rights, other agencies are out there as well. And aside from the cannabis program and going out on warrants, each of these agencies we've had one form of partnership or interaction with in a variety of cases that we work on throughout the region. Let's not forget the local agencies, our counties, and we interact with each of them on various levels, whether it be their planning and building departments, code enforcement, environmental health, and even their district attorneys. And sometimes our staff has acted as expert witnesses in some cases.
Back up one.
You got it.
I don't see the Forest Service. No room on the slide?
Probably a formatting issue. Okay, definitely something fine. I should acknowledge. Good catch. I will say that in the enforcement program, we don't work with them as much. I think we have more of a compliance assistance relationship with them. So maybe that's a good thing from their view that they're not on the slide. You bet. So just to frame up again today what our priorities and the discussion around them, for example, the State Water Board's priorities are compliance rates with the performance metrics that are established statewide, collaboration, performance, communication. You can see other agencies, other regional water board priorities if you visit the link that I've provided there. And you can think about priorities in a way that they could be programmatic, or impact or case specific. You can also think about the screening criteria that goes along with those and how we eventually take a case and before it gets to formal enforcement and we elevate it up before the board. So here's our current list of enforcement priorities with the focus on the bold. And what I want to note is that these have been our past priorities for a number of years now. And this is the things that we're looking for feedback today. One thing that we are proposing to change, and it is a modification, but it's really more of a slight clarification in the fact that we're going to consider cannabis part of agriculture. We do consider cannabis part of agriculture. And so when we look at the slight revision, we are prioritizing pursuing enforcement cases for violations associated with unauthorized agricultural activity. So I'll further elaborate on some examples of that. Violations associated with unauthorized dredge and fill activities. Again, the key being things that are done without permits. Violation of stormwater permits, that includes NPDES construction, industrial, and municipal stormwater. And of course, missed deadlines on existing enforcement orders. And while this is, that last one is really a bit of our, shall we say, progressive enforcement process, it's just the part of the way that we do our business. We also want to note that it's an important priority, and you just reaffirmed that this morning, so thank you. So further elaborating on unauthorized agricultural activities. Again, cannabis is included in that, and the focus is on unauthorized, unlicensed, unpermitted. The same can be said for vineyard development. This is an example of an unauthorized vineyard development that resulted in severe land disturbance without permits and discharges to waters of the United States and waters of the state. Here you see some grading and some failure from erosion control. And again, unauthorized activities are what we're focusing on. Here on the left, again, we see another vineyard development that took place in Mendocino County, another successful case that was settled. And this was a buried stream that took place in the development of that vineyard. We have had, in both these cases, I think, great success in both restoring the environment and coming to an agreement. And again, a look at what that can look like in an unauthorized dredge and fill situation where that pile of root wads and trees you could see has actually been cleared from the land, and that is where the stream flows. If you look down in the corner or the bottom of that slide, you can see a culvert coming out. And so that's the type of stuff that we encounter out there sometimes when folks are trying to get away with out being noticed by regulatory agencies. We have, over the past few years, been, as you know, pursuing enforcement cases on stormwater permits. I'll elaborate a little bit more later on in some of our successes with that. And our continued presence over the last few years with stormwater has had some notable successes, some that I'll highlight later on again. And of course, again, as I reiterate, missed deadlines in existing orders. So before I jump off of our priorities and head into another topic, I just want to see if the board has any questions or feedback for us at this time.
Just asking for some clarification. The reason for bringing cannabis into the agriculture is because it's an irrigated commodity?
Well, we consider agriculture as another cannabis, just another form of agriculture that does it. It's separate from the irrigated lands program because it has that program has its own distinct development. And when you think of things statewide, there's more of an irrigated lands program focus on other commodities. But as far as agriculture in the greater umbrella, that's what we're referring to when we're bringing in cannabis. And I just want to really emphasize it's the unauthorized development, and that's where we see a lot of problems. We still see noncompliance and some significant issues, I would say, from time to time in rolled sites. But bringing that in, we do look at that as when it comes to water quality, land disturbance, and the use of various chemicals or land application of those or the movement and manipulation of water and how they can adversely affect water quality, we see them to have that commonality.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Just to follow up, Hector, I asked that same question during my briefing yesterday, and as a follow-up question, I asked about agriculture or cannabis being enrolled in agriculture or using those that term together. I'd asked if anyone knew of county ag commissioners putting cannabis in their crop reports. And Executive Officer Quinto jumped on it. And apparently there are a couple in our region, a couple of ag commissioners that put addendums onto their crop report to try and quantify cannabis production. So there are people sticking their toe into recognize it as another form of agriculture. So
Mendocino Ag Commissioner has done that for some time, I believe.
Andy DeGrassi did
microphone,
that a
please.
Long time ago. So yes. Anyway, I caught the same thing you did. And
thanks. Great question. Any others? Before I move on. Okay. So we've covered the priorities a little bit, and it's the slight revision that we're making to those this year as far as, you know, again, consolidating some of the terminology and making that a little more streamlined. I'd like to talk a little bit about our performance metrics. So in addition to these priorities, which we apply when we're evaluating cases or situations for further formal enforcement, we have annual performance targets or performance metrics with the State Board as shown here. And target one is associated with, well, really both of these targets are mainly associated with wastewater. And when you look on the screen to the right, you see an image and a schematic of the city of Arcata's wastewater treatment plant. And we've been working with them extensively over the past few years on some of the violations that they have reoccurring. And now when we're talking about the targets, Class A violations are defined by the enforcement policy. And in short, they're egregious violations or violations that may even threaten public health. So, and the MMPs are also those that are, you know, codified. Clean Water Act, we're implementing federal authority there. And it's important to make the distinction that we're really busy balancing our priorities of discretionary enforcement and then meeting these targets. Now, to be clear, separate from our priorities, which we establish here at the board and through feedback with you and the public, these targets are developed by enforcement staff statewide, and they're applicable statewide. So all of the enforcement units through all the 9 regional water boards are also meeting and set to meet and addressing these two enforcement metrics. So now that you've seen those performance metrics, I'd like to further elaborate on how we implement them here in the North Coast. And most of these are coming from, again, wastewater facilities that serve disadvantaged communities, small disadvantaged communities, with the exception of Eureka, that is a large disadvantaged community. And when following through on mandatory minimum penalty violations, we often issue these administrative civil liabilities, and we go into confidential settlement negotiations where we work with these folks. They are also civil servants, working in their community and serving their local community. And we try to find projects that will correct the violations or further enhance the environment in the community. So I want to take the time to recognize a couple that we're particularly proud of. And it's just worth noting that this is allowed under the enforcement policy as it comes to turning these mandatory minimum penalties into a compliance project. And an MMP generally is a $3,000 automatic fine. So they can rack up. They can be anywhere between a $3,000 fine. And we have one right now that we're working with. You could see that we've issued a liability, and we're preparing to amend a liability with the small disadvantaged community of Lolita that has nearly $750,000 of MMPs that have racked up. And that's an unfortunate situation that we are working closely with that community on. And we're optimistic, and I hope to be able to provide a good progress report, such as the one that we have for Rio Del right now. So Rio Del racked up a number of MMPs a few years ago, and they put that money back to a compliance project to address the violations. They were having disinfection byproducts coming out from their chlorination process, and they figured out what the problem was. They proposed a solution. They ran a pilot project, and they were successful in addressing and resolving those violations. So since this project, we haven't seen any MMPs from Rio Del. And it's worth acknowledging the good work that they did out there and how we were able to use this tool to help improve the facility.
Jeremiah, just want to catch our legal counsel over there. So this is an example where a compliance project is acceptable. And correct me if I'm wrong, but this board has been chastised by the state in the past for considering what I would consider compliance projects for some civil liability cases that have been brought to us. Am I correct in seeing a parallel there in what this board has tried to do and what Jeremiah is explaining to us right now?
Well, so what Jeremiah is discussing is these mandatory penalties.
Right.
The statute requires certain penalties for certain violations. But if the penalties are being assessed against a POTW in a small disadvantaged community, statute allows, and the enforcement policy in accordance with statute also allows for those penalties, those MMP penalties, to instead of, you know, the community writing a check to the state board for those penalties, they can propose a compliance project to upgrade the facility in lieu of paying that penalty amount. And that's consistent with what this board has expressed in terms of encouraging those compliance projects rather than assessing penalties. And that's what Jeremiah is speaking to. When we have these disadvantaged communities that meet the criteria, instead of monetary penalties, a compliance project is proposed. And I know the board has expressed an interest in expanding that ability for compliance projects in other circumstances. And right now, the enforcement policy doesn't allow that, but the enforcement policy could be amended in the future, and there might be more latitude, potentially.
I just couldn't help but recognize the similarities of what's being discussed here and what the action that this board has done in the past to achieve compliance to address the problem and not put an undue burden on the violator. So just wanted to make note that I noticed that. Thank you.
Well, thank you for the comment. I appreciate that. I think you see that your staff are always trying to find these compliance projects. I've got a couple of other examples to share with you, and then an update, I think, on the case that you're referring to as well. How about the city of Ukiah? They've come up a couple times. They recently had some mandatory minimum penalties, and they were able to reinvest that into a improved screw press, a dewatering system that has helped with their facility upgrades. It's also worth noting that the city of Ukiah has done some fantastic work over the past few years outside of this context, but just wanting to thank them for their work with recycled water and the amount of work that their staff and, you know, Sean White has come before this board before with concerns about the Russian River. And I can tell you that he does a very fine job, him and his staff over there running this operation for the city of Ukiah. So we haven't seen additional violations from them recently either. One more that I want to note, the last one on the compliance project front and good stories to tell, is the city of Eureka. They had some MMPs and they chose a supplemental environmental project. That's one where it could either be pollution reduction or other forms of restoration or even studies. But in here they did, as you can see in these photos, did some low impact development retrofits to treat stormwater runoff from various streets and parking lots throughout the city and therefore improving water quality in the watershed. So this brings me now to a concept that I wanted to run past you all on: what do we do at the staff level and what comes before the board? The iceberg concept a little bit. And a lot rises up to your attention, but there's a lot that also happens below the waterline, if you will. And again, policy requires progressive enforcement and informal actions, which is where so much work can be done. And in this view, I just want to reiterate that you do see administrative liabilities, cease and desist orders, time schedule orders. You know, a cleanup and abatement order could come before the board. That's delegated to the executive officer, and the same can be said with settlements. You've seen settlements come before you before and informational orders. But a lot of these things get they take place without the board getting to have feedback or engagement directly through a formal hearing. And really, I've got some great stories to share with you on some of these successes that we have over the past few years. And I just want to reiterate that all the while, during this progressive enforcement, as you see on the slide, we are also doing compliance assistance. Even all the way through at the very bottom bullet you see, which came up in an earlier item this morning, collections and monetary judgments. So those are things that we definitely pursue and are priorities for us, as we're speaking so much today about our priorities. I'm going to take a few minutes to go over some statistics from the past few years, but again, just kind of looking at, if we're looking from, you know, right to left, I've got the fiscal years up here, going from fiscal year 2021 all the way to the last fiscal year of 24-25, and in these bars, it's showing each of those years, and then it's kind of working its way through a progressive enforcement path as well. So you see a lot comes out in the notice of violation. That's where the massive amount of work that staff do and the majority of actions that we take. Of course, there are dozens of formal enforcement actions, from cleanup and abatement orders to ACLs, ACLOs. Let's take a look at it again, keeping that theme in mind about the number of actions that we take and what comes before the board and what doesn't. If we look back at the last couple of years on the left, you see fiscal year 23-24. Again, the majority of actions being notices of violation. We had a big push that year with notices of noncompliance in the stormwater program for folks that weren't reporting or weren't enrolled. And then when we shift over and look at 24-25, the fiscal year, still consistently NOVs being the majority of actions, informal enforcement leading to progressive enforcement. A few more cleanup and abatement orders in this past year, consistent with recent strategies that have come before you, as well as formal actions. And now you're seeing time schedule orders and a cease and desist order there as well, tools that we will be imploring more as we continue to move through our enforcement strategies. So here represents the programs, and you can see the majority of actions coming out of the cannabis program, and that doesn't necessarily mean that that's where we're finding all of the egregious violations. It also has to do with the fact that that is a priority, that we are staffed up on that, and that we have regular engagement and help from other agencies in addition to our own. But those numbers are a combination of actions that here in the region have taken with some assistance from State Board. Again, thanking them for their help. One thing that you may note when shifting over the past couple of years is that there has been, as Executive Officer Quinto has noted a few times, that we've done some more enforcement now in the Scott and Shasta, that's there in the irrigated lands where we've had some actions. And you see consistently that we have enforcement actions in our stormwater programs, wastewater, our waste discharge to land programs, timber, and the 401 is our stream and wetland program. Any questions about any of those statistics before I move on? Great. Jumping to complaints. Now, you've already heard me say this in years past. It's worth repeating that we as a regulatory agency pride ourselves on being very responsive and accountable to our mission and to the public. And here are some statistics that we took from our complaints database. There is a complaint portal, a Cal EPA portal. It's on, you want to file a complaint, you can find it on the homepage of all of our websites. And when we look at how we've been doing over the past 3 years, this is the closed rate of complaints. Some of these complaints are still ongoing. And as we look at the numbers over the years, I've got some other statistics to share from you as far as what's the distribution in the programs that we're getting. Want me to back up?
No, just a question. Who's the first one to see that complaint when it gets filed?
That's the guy right behind me. Jordan Felak is our complaints coordinator. He has the job of taking those complaints and filtering them and assigning them to various programs or offloading them to maybe local agencies that it may be more appropriate or other agencies. For example, I've got some stats here showing how many we get that are water right related. So, yes, it comes to the enforcement unit, and that's something that we manage, again, trying to provide that service to the office and stay engaged with those regulatory units where we can provide support or where others can as well.
Jeremiah, may I ask on the water right complaints that y'all get, how many of those, like, also include I think there's situations where the public doesn't know where to go with it because there's water quality impacts along with maybe the water rights. I mean, what do you guys do with those? Do you assess if there are water quality issues and address those specifically, or can you take on the water right element? I mean, how does that work?
That's a great question. We very much want to stay in our lane, so we might do a joint inspection. There are times when there are water quality and water right issues, working with Josh Curtis on a couple of those right now, where we have orders out where there are both quality and quantity right issues, shall I say. And so we parse those out appropriately. If it's strictly within water rights, we hand that off to them and we leave it to them to then close out the complaint itself. So we're not 100% responsible for the closure rate on all of those, as they can go to a number of other agencies as well. Does that help?
Yes, even if it's frustrating, but yes.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I get that.
Mr. Chair, yes. I'm looking at the numbers. 55 are non-governmental agencies, and then 56 are external partners, county, city, or state agencies, I would gather.
Right.
So What are the nature of the complaints from Sonoma County or the City of Santa Rosa or Department of Water Resources? Are these different types of complaints? How are they characterized?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's kind of a broad answer. But one thing that I can give a couple of examples in the way of thinking of the other day, a gentleman had a water right complaint. And he was just happy to find a live body here at the Regional Water Board. And so I explained to them that, well, the issue that he's dealing with the diversion and his groundwater well going dry isn't something that we particularly have jurisdiction over here at the Water Board. Of course, that affects water quality, and it's a concern of ours. But when it comes to who has jurisdiction over that, that's more of, say, a local agency. Is there a groundwater sustainability agency associated with the county or a local jurisdiction? Is that something that might actually have a right with water rights? So we have to triage those here, and we put our heads together. Sometimes they're real head scratchers. Other times it's something as simple as I drove by something the other day where there was a big stockpile of dirt out in Sebastopol. Somebody was concerned. They filed a complaint that was referred to the local county, and county had already gone out and issued a corrective action notice and posted it on there. So while that could also fall within our jurisdiction, the county also has responsibility under their stormwater regulations and had already taken a lead, which I was very happy to report back on, that the county was already on the complaint. So sometimes we get them that fall in our shop, and sometimes we get them that don't, and sometimes they do. And honestly, sometimes when they hit a brick wall or somebody that's a little stubborn, we might need to step back in and provide our support on those complaints, as the locals might get blown off, which we also see from time to time. So we really see a breadth of complaints that sometimes people are just happy to get a live body and trying to navigate bureaucracy. And we also take pride in being able to get people to the right place.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Great. So here is what they look like by county, and you can see over the past 3 years. I should have elaborated in that past slide that the bars that you're seeing are from each of the fiscal year. The table is from the last one, but the bars are to show that things have remained relatively consistent. Vast majority of complaints come from residents in Sonoma County, followed up by Humboldt County and then Mendocino. That could just be associated with population. Now, we really couldn't talk about complaints before this board without identifying one of the significant issues that we're dealing with in the Russian River watershed and the complaints that have come before this board and through the Cal EPA portal that we've received, and that's Coyote Valley Dam. This board has engaged in conversation in public forum with complainants and has had curiosity to what it is that we are doing here. And the update that I can provide is that most recently in the last, well, a few months ago now, I think May, the biological opinion was revised by the National Marine Fisheries Service. Yeah, that was May 2025. And we've met with them, and we have had some discussions around the content of that. We are also evaluating that biological opinion at this moment. And we are exploring our regulatory authority and how that might complement the biological opinion that National Marine Fisheries Service has issued. Now, I want to be clear that this is an enforcement update, but we are not in an enforcement action context with this at this moment. We are considering an investigation and looking into the data that we've received and how, again, our authority could complement that biological opinion. And investigations don't necessarily come automatically with enforcement. So I just wanted to be clear that even though we're giving that update, because it's complaints, Jordan's the complaint coordinator, and we found ourselves engaged in this process, we're going to continue to stay engaged and as your unit here in the enforcement team. But just want to be really clear, at this point, we don't have any formal enforcement plans. One other thing that I would mention is that we are also engaged in parallel efforts, which are happening now. I'm sure many of you might have already heard that there are additional feasibility studies looking at improvements to Coyote Valley Dam that would improve resilience towards climate change, increase storage, and even Congressman Huffman himself had mentioned that in addition to that, there could be water quality benefits that could come along with those projects. So simultaneously to the biological opinion and our assessment of those conditions, there's also parallel efforts, and our staff in the non-point source division are working and keeping track of those, as there may need, we may need to issue a water quality certification depending on what these feasibility analysis determine. That would be in conjunction with the state board. Really too early to determine. They're looking at all these things right now, but I thought it would be good to just mention that, that there is even more attention placed on the dam at this point. Any questions on that before we move on? Chair Bedoya.
Kind of a parallel, since you're speaking about a dam. Mm-hmm. There's PG&E's decommissioning a couple of dams and they're going to be taken down. Could you speak to our role in that?
Or is that? I can do that.
That'd be great.
Just very briefly.
Please.
So that, to my knowledge, we haven't received any complaints related to that facility, but it is something that the regional board is engaged with as a partner. That is a FERC-regulated project, and as such, the water board's primary permitting role sits with the state water board. So when a project is proposed to decommission the Potter Valley project and associated infrastructure, the current plan is that the state water board would take the lead on the 401 water quality certification associated with that project, similar to the way we interacted with the and continue to interact with the Klamath Dam removal and restoration. We envision that the regional board staff will provide some level of technical support to state board as they prepare that 401 water quality certification and oversee compliance with the terms of that certification as the project is implemented. There could also be a role, depending on the configuration of that project, there could be a role for the regional board in if the project needs to enroll in the construction stormwater general permit. We would oversee compliance with that permit. There could be some separate permitting for restoration activities, and the regional board staff would oversee compliance with those permits as well, and also implement enrollments and that kind of thing and for restoration permitting. So still to be determined as we see the details of the project, but the plan is, much like the Klamath, to have state board take on the primary permitting role and the regional board in more of a supporting role.
Thank you very much. I wanted to get that in there.
Great. Well, and just as a time check, now I want to let you know that I've got about 12 more slides to go, so we're getting there. Thanks for your time, attention, and patience and engagement. So on the topics that have come before the board, just as a reminder that we do include these updates in the EO articles that we issue, always making sure to dot our I's and cross our T's in those reports. You know what I'm saying there. And for cases that have come before the board over the recent years, like Zhong, Zagora, and the Suarez case, each of those resulted in noncompliance. And in follow-ups, the Office of Enforcement has turned to issuing liens on those. And the in instance with Suarez and what the board adopted, we did not hear back from them. As you heard this morning, not only have we put a lien on that property, but other assets that are owned as well. Some other projects that are worth...
Jeremiah, just a question.
Of course.
And you can defer this to council, but several years ago, the sheriff in Mendocino County instituted a program of asset forfeiture when people wouldn't pay their fines. I mean, it's a pretty draconian step to go in and remove people's property. And there's been some big decisions that have come before this board, or this board has made some big decisions with some hefty fines.
Yeah.
Even though it may be draconian to consider asset forfeiture for collection on some of these large amounts, is that something the state has ever considered or has ever done that you're aware of?
Boy, not to my knowledge. Nate, do you have any examples?
I don't. We had a case, it's probably about 10 years ago now. It was an early cannabis development case, and we did proceed with trying to track down personal property, vehicles, and that sort of thing. But... we never got to the point of actually recovering any of that property or any of those assets. It's very resource intensive to do so, and ultimately we did go down that path with vehicles and that sort of thing, but we never did actually recover.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, great question. Another case that I'd like to highlight that did come before the board for a referral, I think is a great success, and that it was the Joshua Sweet case that's led by your staff with, led by Josh Curtis and Shannon Utley, who's been our representative in the cannabis program. You heard Shannon announce getting her promotion today. That was a multi-agency settlement where a number of, as again, when we go out on cannabis sites, we've got water rights, fish and wildlife. I think this was a challenge, but a great success. And one thing that I would note is that our fears were realized in the fact that that pond did fail, and that is still being addressed through that settlement negotiation. So still, I think, a success and an ongoing situation that we're hoping that we're, and I think we are moving in the right direction on that. And wanted to note, again, an update, and I think a great success. So moving on to another item that came before the board in the last few years, the Ken Borellis Fox Meadows Timber Harvest. That's now tied up in the courts. So we're awaiting decisions to hear what happens there. The petition, there's a petition window, and then there's opportunities to go through the court. So at the moment, that's locked up there, and I can report back in the enforcement report or at a later update on the status of this case. On a case which you saw me bring before the board years ago, Sonoma Luxury Resorts, Saggio Hills Construction, that was a $6.4 million liability that this board adopted. That spent, well, about 5 years in the courts. Thank you, Mr. Jacobson, for his work supporting that adopted order. That has now gone through the courts. We're victorious, I would say, and that liability has been paid in full. Just a quick update on Mark West Corey, that liability has also been paid in full. And any questions on any of these cases? Great, moving on, case is closed. Some of them, again, coming back to our prioritizing our programs and the areas that we want to put our attention to. I want to continue to look at it through the iceberg metaphor and take the time to give you some of those cases updates that I've mentioned previously. And so here's a cannabis site that we inspected in the spring of 2021. The McMurphy site is a criminal search warrant where we observed threats of discharge, unauthorized development with setbacks and legacy feature issues. Mr. McMurphy was enrolled in the program, and in order to avoid a cleanup and abatement order, he chose to maintain that enrollment, reclassify his site as a high risk, engage in retaining a qualified professional to develop plans and permit applications to do the in-stream work, and ultimately clean up this site. So following the development of our memorandum and inspection findings, they were able to successfully remediate the site, and all violations have been resolved, and they've been terminated from the program. So there's an example of something that doesn't have to rise up to the board and that staff are resolving on the ground in these programs. We also have the Iraheta case, where initially it was discovered during a criminal search warrant in 2023. This one moved fast, and we're proud to report back on that, where not only was there cultivation within setbacks, but that greenhouse is actually in a stream. Yeah, and they and they had burnt trash and refuse and garbage everywhere, and staff quickly issued a notice of violation and went to issue a cleanup and abatement order. After just getting the draft cleanup and abatement order, they were cooperative, and that's all it took. They've cleaned it up. They're no longer cultivating. A great success story, and a thank you to Kate Hawking and her work on that. Now, here's an instance where it did take a little while. We've got a site that Ms. Adona White has been working on and recently closed. 2017, initially, we found this issue, and in March 2018, there was a significant pond failure that was built up and had this unauthorized discharge. And we did issue a cleanup and abatement order in April of 2013, and we had combined efforts with California Department of Fish and Wildlife, and we were successful in getting the site cleaned up and remediated and all the things that needed to be fixed out there, the drainage and the restoration of the hillside. Sometimes when it's a big problem, it can take a little bit longer to fix and to ensure that they are stabilized and things are working well, that drainage is adequately provided and protected, no longer threatening a big hillside slope failure or pond discharge. And now we get all the way to just a few months ago in May 25, a no further action letter and another success story.
What community or what county and what community was that in?
I want to say that this one was in northern Mendocino County. I could double check and get certain on that.
Branscombe?
Yeah.
Branscombe?
I'll have to double check. All right. Can't recall right off the top of my head. I'll get back to you on that one. Thanks. Adona would know right off the top of her head, but I've seen so many in the last few months that they start to blend together, but I will get an answer for you on that one.
I just looked it up in adopted orders, and it's Humboldt.
It's listed
in our adopted orders.
The hardwood case.
Actually, there's two hardwood. There's a cleanup hardwood cleanup abatement order in Humboldt.
There's also
a hardwood cleanup and abatement order in Mendocino. So,
I think it was the Mendo one.
Okay.
I'd have to double check. Thank you for always being so quick on the draw.
Too quick.
No, there's a bunch of them that you can see now. Okay, now I feel better about not being precise on that. Here's one that I'm pretty confident in where I know the location, just outside of Hopland, and you've seen this come before you, and it came from complaints, and this is a case that we are very proud of here in resolving impacts to the neighboring community, Ray's Station. I'll move on quickly in that after the bankruptcy, Deutsch family came in and bought this with eyes wide open. They have been great at communicating with us. We don't see the need to reissue a cease and desist order. In fact, we're going to combine all those regulatory orders of the cease and desist order, the cleanup and abatement order, and the investigative order all into one cleanup order. We're going to enroll them in a general order, and they're going to be operating again soon. They have found alternative disposal methods, and they're improving their treatment. We haven't had a single complaint, and I just want to give thanks to the representatives of the Deutsch family as this issue has been resolved, and we expect them to just follow up on a few things for us to ensure that there are no ongoing and continuing threats to surface water or groundwaters from some of the discharges and pond failures that occurred during the time we issued the cease and desist order. This is why I was taking a gander at your jacket there, Board Member McKenzie. We got a complaint from the Marin-Sonoma County Mosquito Abatement District, and we acted on it. This is out in West County of Sonoma, the Manzana Industrial Facility, where they produce all kinds of apple products, apple juices and sauces and such, and they have been enrolled in a land discharge permit. You can see there in the image the pond adjacent to Atascadero Creek, and they had been long land applying their processed wastewater. However, they did run into a problem. We got a complaint, and they were basically flooding out, and it was intermingling with the creek, and because of the threatened pond failure, they were actually pumping directly into the creek, which is an unauthorized discharge. They are not authorized to discharge directly to surface waters. They had a land application permit. I'm very happy to report that we issued one notice of violation. Now, the key part here is we got engagement from very qualified professionals. Former board member and great colleague, Mr. David Norin, came to us with a fantastic idea of pairing two hard situations together to make a better one. He proposed that they connect to the Grayton Wastewater Treatment Facility and completely eliminate their discharge. A couple years go by, and as a result of one complaint, two inspections, one notice of violation, and a lot of good work from David Norin as a qualified professional and Tina Wallace, their attorney, they were able to now hook up to Grayton, who needs service, who needs ratepayers and a consistent ratepayer in Manzana. And so our presence here has resulted in a great deal of improvement out there and protection of water quality for that local creek. And I just want to thank David for that work on that. And it, again, underscore the point of when we get a good qualified professional that has great vision on how things can be fixed, it doesn't take a lot of effort on our end to reiterate what should be done, and they find great options of towards compliance.
Jeremiah, that facility sold recently. Has communication been ongoing good?
Yeah, I checked into their self-monitoring reports not too long ago, and they're still letting us know because they are routing that discharge through the pond still before it goes. It's part of the treatment train, but before it goes to that discharge. So all things considered, they're still moving along. I don't frankly know the status of the business side of it, but I know that they're still active. Yeah. I'd also like to highlight a success case that was a great settlement under the leadership of Assistant Executive Officer Claudia Villacorta, who led us with, and of course, great staff work on that end in the program as well. Here we had a really egregious stormwater discharges. I want to highlight the local agency partnership with the City of Santa Rosa. And note that we did get a $800,000 settlement in accordance with the policy. Half of that settlement went to the cleanup fund, and another half went to a wetland restoration project that is being managed by another local partner, the Laguna Foundation. And so here you see these discharges that staff had observed, and rather egregious. One more thing, just to really emphasize that middle bullet. In preparing for this update before the board, I'd been gathering input, having conversations with regulatory program staff, and our construction stormwater lead, Mr. Dragolowski, has really expressed how great our enforcement program has emboldened and empowered the local agencies. In fact, even after Saugeo Hills, I saw the City of Healdsburg issue citations and modest penalties for noncompliance. So as we lead the way, we further empower those local agencies that help protect water quality. Okay, we're coming down the home stretch. So just wanted to thank you for your time and attention and engagement today. I want to cap this off by covering our plans for the upcoming fiscal year. And as we discussed earlier, doing a little bit of fine tuning to our priorities, consolidating cannabis into agriculture. And then continuing on with the rest of those priorities that we have been with success over the past few years. Of course, we continue complex case management, MMPs, Class A violations, and priority violations that come from complaints or observed by program staff out there. We average 10 complaints a month. That's a hefty workload to share around. I'll note, as we did in preparing for this, most of our regulatory programs make plans. We in the enforcement unit are reactive. And so it's hard to tell how many violations is a wastewater treatment plant going to have? How many complaints are we going to get? So prioritization, screening are all very important when it comes to determining what cases get advanced through formal enforcement. We'll keep you apprised of those in our EO reports and ongoing enforcement actions. Emphasizing that a key part of us, I heard it this morning in the questions in the Harding item, liens and monetary judgments. We are on top of those. We are filing those appropriately, or we are following up with either legal counsel like Nate, or sometimes the Office of Enforcement is helping us out with those. In fact, Ms. Jidkoff, who you saw just this morning, has been instrumental in helping attain a couple of those in various instances. And I want to note, last but not least, we are currently, and Jordan's helping me get an answer to the EPA right now on a follow-up question, undergoing what's called the US EPA State Review Framework. This is a regularly scheduled audit by the US EPA, and it's Region 1's turn. They are looking at our stormwater and wastewater enforcement programs. So all the things that I've just covered from those types of MMPs and egregious violations, and even some of these cases that I mentioned, are being handed over to the EPA to ensure that we're doing them in accordance with the federal laws and regulations.
Mr. Chair, this is with EPA Region 9?
That is correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. So, this is the last slide that I have, just kind of prompting you for any discussion topics if you further wish to engage at any point now or later on the enforcement priorities. Do you have any programmatic questions or any requests for information, other informational items on enforcement, whether it be process or case specific? I'm all ears. I just want to thank you again for your time and attention today.
And I can just briefly interject that enforcement staff Adona White is also quick on the draw, and she emailed Jeremiah and I to let us know that that Harwood site is in southern Humboldt near Miranda in the Salmon Creek watershed, tributary to the South Fork Eel River.
Thanks, Donna.
Thank you so much. I'd like to know in a couple of years, if I'm still around, if there are positive trends in closing these complaints, these cases, with especially with the progressive enforcement, the accelerated enforcement that is taking place.
Yes, thank you,
Mr. Chair. Just in terms of the iceberg slide that you showed under the water line, we do get through the executive director's report. There's always an enforcement report, and here it's authored by Monica Bueno, and it does in fact talk to things that have been going on under the waterline. Staff issued 12 notices of violation, directives to modify enrollment for risk level, and 2 NFAs. Continue settlement negotiations on 5 cases. City of Eureka did the work you talked about under the LID program, and the Regional Water Board issued 2 ACL complaints. And then we have, as you well know, a list of enforcement actions that are going on. So from this board member's point of view, I'm always interested at the end of the executive director's report to see that, in fact, we do get an update, an overview of what's going on under the waterline.
I appreciate that. That just makes my heart sing, and I know that Monica...
Thank you for all the enforcement work.
Thank you, Board Member McKenzie.
Board members, any other questions?
We do have a member of the public, I believe, signed up to comment on this item via Zoom. Deidre,
okay.
Is he on Zoom?
Please let him in.
Hi, Don. Can you unmute and make sure we can hear you? And I'll pull up the timer in just a minute.
Thank you so much. I am unmuted.
We can hear you. Thank you.
Great. Thank you for confirming that. Really glad to hear this item. I just want to start out by thanking the staff and the board members for your role in enforcement compared to 25 years ago. I'm seeing this becoming what it should be, which is a deterrent effect. As you all know, laws and regulations are only as good as the enforcement. If the CHP didn't issue a few tickets out there, people would speed with impunity. They can't catch every speeder. But people knowing that there might be repercussions for their actions is so important. And I just really see a profound change compared to when I started doing my present job and today. And you know, really looking at people like Sonoma Luxury Resorts, you know, Jeremiah talked about the iceberg. That's one of those things that made it into your board meetings. That is what the enforcement process at the end of the line really has to bring to bear on bad actors. I mean, I remember meeting with Robert Green and his team in 2005 when they were planning the development, and letting them know how erosive the area they're planning their development is, based on our experience with the development of Parkland Farms, which released a lot of sediment. So I appreciate the board's support for your staff. When you need to, you take the appropriate action. And again, I just want to reiterate how important it is to the public. When people ignore the rules and laws that this board is charged with enforcing, they're often passing their cost of doing business onto the public. So important is all about, you know, enforcement is all about fairness and making sure when someone, you know, like Sazio Hills tried to send their sediment onto the river and depress its health, which affects everyone in the public, that you're there to take action and make sure that not just that person is brought to account, but it sends a message to everyone else. And I was pleased to hear in Jeremiah's report that the local agencies, especially within the Russian River, are stepping up. There was a lot of times I filed complaints with the city of Vernon Park and the city of Santa Rosa about construction stormwater violations, and we saw almost nothing happen. So I'm really glad to hear that. And I really think it's because of your collective efforts at the staff and board here. And just wanted to take a moment to thank you all. Thanks.
Thank you, Don. Thank you for your work over the years and for your comments. Jeremiah, anything else?
Thank you so much for your time and attention. We'll see you soon.
Thank you for your presentation.
All right.
So I think we're going to break for lunch and go into closed session, unless...
Yes. I just want to make sure that I disclose what is going to be covered in closed session. So the board will be discussing in closed session item 10B, considering the evaluation of performance of a public employee, that being me.
And we will reconvene thereafter. I'm going to guess an hour and a half.
I guess as if AGP is ready to come back in an hour, we could say in an hour or more, just to.
Okay. Yeah. So noted. Thank you. So we're going to break for lunch and go into closed session. Okay, we've returned from closed session. There's nothing to report. We will adjourn the meeting today. We will begin tomorrow's meeting, Friday, August 15th, 2025 at 9 a.m. This meeting is adjourned. Thank you.